In the bomb-making factory.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, I guess that would make sense.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, these are they're fighting a guerrilla war, and that seems to be precisely whether they are suicide bombers or snipers or whatever, they're fighting a guerrilla war on their turf.
What I find amazing is that where do they find, you know, how much arms do they have? And is there new supplies of arms coming in, or are they just picking up scraps? Do they have, what is their arm resource?
I saw a report that talked about some, you know, just plain business people who bought a crate of Kalashnikovs from somebody, and all of these guys had arms and were all prepared to take up arms against the coalition forces.
So you're saying that they're just getting it over the internet?
I don't know.
No, but there's a black market for all of that stuff, and there's been, you know, there have been things kind of lying around in people's basements and things that they have kind of seized over the last year, things they had before. There's stuff coming in the whole time. You can't ever close up all the methods of getting
really?
That stuff.
Well, you would think they would have been able to close off the black market trade. Or maybe, I guess in all wars, there's sort of like a nonpartisan contingent of businessmen that are always selling bombs and arms to the, you know, both sides.
Mm-hmm.
But here's where, you know, I think that, you know, Bush spoke incorrectly over the weekend. He said when he was at his ranch over the weekend, these were some of his public comments he made, after he's been in his ranch since April 5th, folks. It's just a few people causing the trouble in Iraq. It's just a few people. So as if there are, you know, a couple of
people. You said a gang, right?
A gang, either a gang or some gangs, a few thugs. It's like, no. I mean, what's happening is that the initial violence was started last week by the most, you know, rambunctious, rebellious, you know, angry of all the people there. But the reason that it's continuing is that they are tapping into very strong feelings of a large number of the Iraqi people. And that's why this is why the uprising from the Sunnis in the north and the Shias in the south is so successful and is so difficult to snuff out.
So you're saying it's not just a nationalistic, not just a spiritual movement, but they're also appealing to a sense of Iraqi nationalism among the people that live there.
I don't know if it's spiritual at all. I would say,
well, it's provoked by
al-Sadir. It's kind of radical, and it's about frustration and anger, and it's about increasing anger the longer the U.S. coalition forces are there, looking more like occupiers, less like liberators, that people whose lives seem to, you know, are without electricity, without jobs, without any kind of order, and people are incredibly angry at the killing of innocent Iraqis, women and children, no matter what the Americans say with any of these big attacks. Oh, it's just, it turns out always that it's not insurgents, they're women and children. People are angry.
Yeah, yep.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. When we come back, why is John Kerry too busy for Tony Blair? As Air America Radio rolls on.
Air America Radio.
It's so well.
Air America Radio. Before it's too late.
I'm Sue Ellicott on Air America, here with Mark Maron and Mark Riley. Okay, John Kerry, the presumptive...
Wait, he's the dude that's running for the thing?
Was that my sentence, the presumptive?
Oh, go ahead.
The presumptive Democratic presidential candidate apparently says he is too busy to see Tony Blair, the British Prime Minister, when he comes here this week to see George Bush. Now, actually, I think this is probably a smart thing for Kerry to do.
I thought that they should get together and kick out some jams. Because
yeah.
They both play guitar.
They both play guitar. Oh. Yeah.
I think it would have been funny if Kerry just showed up at the White House with his guitar and said, is Tony here? Because I want to jam.
I think that is so hideous, that idea. These two guys, neither of whom is the slightest bit hip, trying to convince us that they're really kind of laid back, down and dirty guys and play the guitar.
Why is it a good thing?
They play Jingle Bells or something. I think it's a good thing because I think that Kerry should just sort of stay out of looking too political. I think that Bush is doing a very good job on sinking himself at the moment.
Himself.
Yeah,
and
he's
I think
hurting
Blair's,
himself. And I've been wondering, why is Kerry being so quiet? And I've been a bit disappointed that no one's coming back. And I think actually... it looks so political and so partisan in a fight that is a race that's already the nastiest in living memory, that it's a good thing to let the White House do what President Bush did over the weekend. I had to write this down. I read, this is one of his remarks he made at his ranch yesterday. I am satisfied that I never saw any intelligence that indicated there was going to be an attack on America at a time and place.
He has to qualify it with the time and place thing.
No, he should have stopped with intelligence.
Yeah.
Just read the sentence up to intelligence.
But there are several things wrong on there. First of all, I am satisfied. Like, no, you should not be. You should be incredibly dissatisfied, if not furious, that I never saw any intelligence. Well, did you read any? Did anybody tell you about any?
I think that his proxy, you know, keeping away, that Kerry keeping away from Blair is also detaching from, you know, the war in general in terms of how it's being carried out. Because you know, the alliance between Bush and Blair is as you said before, is getting kind of ugly. And I think it's the best thing he could do is just to sort of lay low and watch them
and stay away
fight
from
it
both
out.
Of them. Oh,
yeah.
I mean, he's meeting Blair and Bush are meeting when?
16th Friday.
Friday.
Right.
So Kerry could have met with him a day earlier because he would have been he's here Thursday.
But well, they're doing other things. They said they had a scheduling conflict that they're busy.
Maybe it's a jealousy issue. It's like, you know, maybe Bush was sort of like, you know, I don't want you hanging out with him.
I think it's partly nervousness. I mean, I don't know if you remember in the that there'd been all sorts of missteps with people trying to influence the elections in other countries, especially involving the US and Britain. John Major, who was Margaret Thatcher's successor, tried to dig up all sorts of dirt, got people who worked for him to dig up dirt on Bill Clinton in the elections during his Oxford days,
right,
which completely backfired. And Tony Blair, who was not then Prime Minister, clearly, but was a Labour MP, said that he thought this was, you know, disgraceful practice. So
you're saying that John Kerry doesn't want to meet with Tony Blair because it would make him look bad. Is that what you're sort of saying?
I think it could make him look
right.
bad. I think he's looking... he's not looking fantastically great because he's not saying anything really, you know, dynamic at the moment. But he's also, no one can criticize him and say that he is piling onto Bush and being partisan.
Do you think that some of it has to do with his lack of desire to take some sort of, to actually comment on the day-to-day of Iraq? I mean...
It might have to do with his lack of liveliness.
Well, that's a criticism. But, I mean, it's like there was so much going on a day-to-day level within the war itself. Do you think that Kerry just doesn't want to put himself in a position to have to comment on the
Maybe.
Day-to-day news?
I think it's just enough going out there, enough that's kind of really sobering. But, look, here's something you guys might like. The BBC is going to screen the first TV sperm race. It's going to be shown as part of an educational series called Lab Rats. And they're going to pit the sperm of two presenters, Dr. Mike Leahy and Zeron Gibson. They're going to film it inside two tiny glass tubes by a microscope and relay it to a crowd watching on a pub's big screen.
Oh, my God. Did they create a little micro sperm track?
Goodness, no.
And they're at the gate. One seems the tail is already moving on the one on the right. I guess you got to name them, too.
How exciting could that possibly be,
yeah,
even after 15 pints of beer?
It can't be exciting because I don't know if you've ever seen sperm under a microscope. They don't, you know, generally do what they're supposed to do. They kind of like, they don't go in a, you know, straight line. They just sort of kind of flail around.
It reminds me of like kids' books when they tell, you know, try to explain to children how babies are made. And they always have, in the British books anyway, they're quite funny. They have these little baby sperm and they all speak sort of like David Beckham.
Right.
And they go like, cool, gotcha, it's a goal.
Yeah.
And they go, I did it, hey.
Uh-oh, don't talk about David Beckham. I saw an article about him, too, in the paper.
Yeah, he's been under siege, is he not?
Yeah, but I mean...
Getting a kid to cross the line to understanding exactly, you know, how tadpoles come out of their pee-pee. That's the tough one. I mean, they could see a sperm, but understanding how it comes out, that's the great gift of adolescence.
Is there an egg at the end?
It's like, sort of like, oh, now I get it.
Is there an egg at the end of this thing, or do they just race to a finish line, or what? How does it work?
Maybe that will be part two.
I
think it's something to do with,
that's a good question. Is there an egg on a little runner, like the little dog on the racetrack, or the rabbit? Yeah, there's an egg, just sort of kind of...
That sounds like a video game that you guys might want to patent.
Well, the big question is, isn't it all about a race of sperm? Isn't this just a metaphor for anything that any? It's all that's all we're doing is trying to get our sperm to win, isn't it?
You guys, you speak for yourselves.
you're part of the process.
Two already won with me.
You know,
well, thanks. That's very gracious of you. I'm so glad to be included.
But it's really about us making strong babies to carry on the great human thing,
the family name.
The great human thing.
Speaking of the great human thing, Shaquille O'Neal.
Yeah.
He's great and human. He's a thing.
Well, let me tell you something. He was in this studio once, and you couldn't see in here. I mean, he took up all the light.
He's huge.
The guy is absolutely gigantic. He also curses a lot, which is what he was doing on TV again yesterday as the Lakers got creamed.
Well, I mean, maybe they should get the cameras out of the locker room. I mean, you can't blame him for cursing. The guy was pissed, you know what I mean?
I agree.
Just lost. It's like, you know, give him a break.
I think that the TV crew should have to pay the fine. If you're going to go in and exploit the fact that people are all hyped up after a game,
I mean, it's
and it's a locker room, for heaven's sake, then they should make the TV crew pay for the whatever they cough up.
Absolutely. Are they trying to make an issue out of it? I mean,
well, you never know. See, he did it before in February.
Yeah.
He was suspended for one game, costing 295 G's, which is wonderful that somebody could make $295,000 for like 48 minutes of play.
Yeah. Today we have our presidential briefing.
I stand at attention?
Yeah, sure. From thewhitehouse.gov. I think you ought to slow that down. He's at the ranch, you know. 7 a.m. Console Dr. Rice about reaction to testimony. 7:15. Get out of bed.
Oh, no. Ouch.
8:30. Attend morning meeting. Remember, no paper football until photographers leave. 9 a.m. Check to see if U.S. has faced a hostage crisis before and if it affected the president's reelection. Okay. 11:30. Greet President Hosni Mubarak of Egypt. Remember, not a pharaoh. 3 o'clock p.m. Stay on message. Too many funerals to attend just one. 8 o'clock, 4 consecutive episodes of 2.5 Men on CBS. Yay! Have Condi explain how the TiVo works. That's the day for our president at the ranch.
That proves she is the smartest one in the White House.
Yeah, I don't know how they work mine.
All right. Coming up.
Oops. You go ahead and tease. Go ahead.
No.
I'm just throwing this away.
Oh, okay.
You lead us into the next thing.
The next big thing. Coming up, some kids got more than they bargained for on an Easter egg hunt, plus 10 questions for John Ashcroft and Mark Maron's morning devotional when we continue here on Air America Radio. But first, news headline.
America with Mark Riley and Mark Maron. And joining us here today is Judd Legum, who has what we call our Salon.com story of the day from their website. Judd is Deputy Research Director at the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C., and co-author of The Progress Report. Okay, I know you want me to say progress, but I just can't do it without laughing. So if you're going to become a regular listener, you're just going to have to get used to it. Progress.
The way you talk?
Yes. I can provide simultaneous translation for
America
a small
fee. America is trying. It's trying.
Okay, good. Judd, hello. Are you with us?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, are you against
Hi,
us?
Hi, Judd.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Pretty good.
Okay, well, we have you on today because we're fascinated that Attorney General John Ashcroft is going to be up on Capitol Hill this week, raising his right hand, pledging his oath, and testifying publicly before the 9/11 Commission. Now, he seems to have got off quite lightly so far, and Condoleezza Rice has said only good things about him. But what questions should the commissioners really be asking him this week?
Well, I mean, I think the first thing that they should look at is what he was doing the day before September 11th, which was submitting a budget proposal to the president, which ignored the FBI's request for more counterterrorism funding. And, you know, this isn't just conjecture. We've got the documents that show that on our website, AmericanProgress.org. You can check them out for yourself, showing that FBI wanted more counterterrorism agents. They wanted more funding for counterterrorism grants, and Ashcroft decided it wasn't a good idea.
Haven't Republicans been trying to, previous to 9/11, been trying to sort of, gut all counterterrorism, funding from like the late 90s?
Well, I think definitely, Ashcroft had different priorities,
mm-hmm.
and that it was very clear when he came in that he did, and he has documents that show it. And they list out his 7 priorities, and that wasn't one of them. So I think, absolutely that the previous administrations had a top priority of counterterrorism, and Ashcroft came in with a very different agenda that they're, of course, trying to spin now for their political convenience, but the facts really don't back them up.
What was the agenda specifically?
Well, he laid out, 7 priorities. This is in another document that we've obtained. And, not all the priorities are bad priorities. You know,
what are they?
Well, you know, things like enforcing criminal law, protecting civil rights.
Oh yeah, they're doing a good job with that.
Yeah, exactly.
Replacing like Constitution that. With Ten Commandments.
So anyway, but these were the stated priorities. But in his initial list, counterterrorism was left completely off the list.
Right.
I mean, it didn't even show up.
But how does this look now, Judd? Now that the presidential daily briefing has been published, reluctantly by the White House over the weekend, how does it look now that Ashcroft was refusing to give money, additional money for counterterrorism?
Well, I think that it really shows that, you know, he had misplaced priorities prior to 9/11 and really after 9/11, because he also was cutting terrorism funding after 9/11, amazingly as well. But I think the other thing that's interesting about that presidential daily brief is it says that there were 70 full-field FBI investigations on al-Qaeda cells in the United States.
Yes, that was amazing, wasn't it?
70, right?
That's
yes,
right. 7-0.
Yeah, 7-0.
Unbelievable.
And it's just interesting to me, what was Ashcroft doing to, you know, do something about that and to alert the president and alert the National Security Advisor, who doesn't think, you know, they needed a meeting where they had to talk about it. But it seems like there were all these investigations going on and no one was doing anything to do something about it, to alert the people who needed to be alerted.
Just like in 2001, during the summer of 2001, before September 11th, John Ashcroft stopped flying commercial airlines. If there was a threat of terrorism, why did he go everywhere he went on a private jet?
If there wasn't a threat of terrorism.
I think the real problem is we don't know, because they refused to release this threat assessment. And I think that's something, you know, just like we needed to have the presidential daily brief released, and that we now know more than we did know now that that's out there, we need to see this threat assessment that John Ashcroft has. You know, he claims that it was a personal threat assessment, it didn't affect anyone else at all. And if that's true, we should just see the document and let's let it get out there.
But Judd, is that maybe one of the questions that 9/11 commissioners could or indeed should be asking? You know, please, we want to see, or why can't we see the threat assessment?
Absolutely, and I think I think that it's just very clear that if the president can release his daily brief, then John Ashcroft can release this threat assessment.
Sounds reasonable.
The fact is that he's been flying around on private jets at cost of taxpayers at $1,600 an hour.
Wow.
Can you give us an idea of some other questions that you would want the commissioners to put to Ashcroft this week?
I think another question to ask is, why did he allow a couple of dozen members of the Bin Laden family to leave the United States just days after 9/11 without even questioning them about any information they might know?
This was when the airspace was actually closed to all air traffic except this flight that went out, right? Or a number of secret
several flights.
We had Greg Unger. He told us about that. I think Ashcroft would probably say, because those are the good Bin Ladens.
Yeah, well, they may very well have been the good Bin Ladens, but the fact is he didn't know. And no one really knows, because they weren't asked any questions. And even if they were the good Bin Ladens, you may know something about your evil brother.
No, absolutely. But who authorized that flight then? It had to go all the way up to the top, right?
Well, I still think an open question as to who exactly did open it up. I think there's some speculation about who it might be, but I don't think they've really pin that down.
Maybe they can blame that on the CIA, too, eventually.
Probably
Now, do you think that Ashcroft, is there any chance that he's going to go down? He's going to really take a big hit here and have to, get out?
Well, I think if the commissioners step up to the plate and do the job that they should do and ask him the tough questions, that he has a really terrible record to defend.
Right.
And I think that he's going to have a lot of trouble, spinning this into a record that, he can say he was fighting counterterrorists, especially in the months before 9/11, but even afterwards, he's got a lot of problems.
Mm-hmm. Actually, Judd, sorry, what's your assessment so far on how tough they are being, the commissioners?
I think that, when you look at Condoleezza Rice's testimony, I think that they're asking a lot of tough questions, and I think that was revealed and, they made them, release that document, which I don't think, if she hadn't gotten asked tough questions, I don't think they would have. I think the problem, in my view, isn't with the commissioners. The problem is you know, it's with the White House trying to stonewall the commission, and that's what's holding things up.
Now, if you were a gambling man, what would you give odds that those flights will come up in front of the 9/11? Do you think somebody from the commission will ask the Attorney General directly about those bin Laden flights?
Well, I hope they would. I hope they would. I mean, I think it's still, I'd still probably say it's a 50-50 proposition at this point, because I think it's seen as a very, you know, sensitive issue or relationship with Saudi Arabia. But, I mean, I think at this point, if you're trying to get to the truth, you got to sort of lay the sensitivities aside and get to the,
Aren't some Americans apparently, you know, pretty upset about this sensitive relationship with the Saudis, given the number of hijackers that were from Saudi Arabia? Are Americans getting tired of hearing this special relationship thing?
Do most of them even know Americans?
You know, probably not. I bet most Americans don't know about the flight still, even with, you know, the new book by Mr. Unger. And I think that, you know, if you were to ask them, and if you were to ask them, you know, what's important, you know, finding out the truth about what happened, you know, maybe helping prevent it the next time, or, you know, protecting some, you know, obtuse, you know, sensitivities with Saudi Arabia, I mean, I think the answer would be pretty much a slam dunk.
Wouldn't it be nice if someone on the commission just asked Ashcroft, like, you know, what's wrong with you? I mean, really? I mean, what happened when you were a kid? What is wrong with you?
I mean, I think that's true. You know, and to be fair, you know, when Ashcroft sees a problem, you know, he is able to address it. You know, if you remember, he used to give his press conferences with that with a bronze statue of a woman that having an exposed breast.
Yeah.
You know, he got together $8,000 and, you know, got it some drapery to cover that up.
As you said before, very, very gently, didn't you say misplaced priorities? What the understatement of the year?
What kind of guy wants to have sex with a statue?
Judge.
Thanks a lot. Hey, is he, you can hang on and take some calls, right?
Is Judge Legum is Deputy Research Director at the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C., and he comes to us today with the Salon.com story of the day.
So, you know, hang out, because we've got the morning devotional, plus what are you praying for this morning? We'll take your calls at 866-303-AAR0. That's 866-303-2270, right here on Air America.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry. I thought we were going.
Say that number. I think he had made some good points about Ashcroft and the questioning that on the Capitol Hill.
Right.
It's good that he's up there. It's pretty staggering. After, you know, Condoleezza Rice really has tried to blame the FBI.
Yeah.
So that Ashcroft has had kind of a free ride up until now. And this week we're going to have Ashcroft testifying, and we're going to have Louis Free, who was like the two times before head of the FBI.
I think the big problem, you know, with the FBI is they really have to stop, you know, working on a commission level. You know, that these guys, they get a commission every time they solve a case, individual agents.
And then Janet Reno is testifying this week as well, isn't she?
Yeah. I believe she is.
The former Attorney General.
So I have some theories about the intelligence community. I'll kick them later, though.
Yeah. Judd, can you still hear us?
I don't think he can.
I think he's
on
hold.
I think he may be on hold. But no, he makes some interesting points, and the question of where law enforcement was, both before and after September 11th, because it's not like Ashcroft exactly, you know, other than the Patriot Act, really led any investigation into any of this. This was a military response we had to 9/11.
Right.
Not a law enforcement one.
But even the military response was a little slow.
Well, yeah, because we still don't have bin Laden yet. So, yeah, and now the American generals are saying, look, we may have talked about trying to get bin Laden by the end of the year, but don't hold us to it.
What is that about? Are they setting him up with a plane flight, too?
I don't know.
Setting him up in like one of...
Extra C for the dialysis machine. I have no idea what they're getting ready to do with bin Laden, or whether or not, you know, some people say bin Laden's on ice and, you know, they're going to hold him until October or November
before
the election and let
him
out.
Those conspiracy theorists, I can't stand them.
Why?
Let's get some callers.
Why can't you stand them?
1-866-303-AAR0.
Why, because they have a...
1-866-303-2270.
What do you think against conspiracy theorists? I mean,
dial us up, guys. Help me out here. I've got a ranting conspiracy guy right
imaginary,
next to me.
Like, it's like they take the news and they apply their imagination to it and try to make, you know, logical leaps of, you know, conjecture.
Help me, callers. Help me. Please. 1-866-303-AAR0. 1-866-303-2270. It's not good enough to be on the internet at www.airamericaradio.com at this point. Please call.
Listen to you pleading like that.
I know. I just you're only a few feet away.
This weird desperate side of you, Sue.
You know how they feel I should have? You know how dogs have those sort of electronic fences that they can't go through? Otherwise, get a little electric shock. I need to put up something around my desk over here for the anti-conspiracy theory attack.
Okay, we got Alan. Alan in Long Island. Are you there, Alan?
Yes.
What's up, buddy?
Hi. I just want to say that I think the morning devotional, my brother and my father are both pastors, and they both mentioned that that's highly offensive to a lot of people, and I think because you're a new radio station, you'd try to be the least bit offensive as you could.
Well, I understand what you're saying, but it's also a little funny. Did they say it was funny at all?
Well, it's like I told the other guy, it would be one thing if a comedian was doing it, because then if someone was offended, they would blame the comedian.
Right.
But when it's a regular thing on the radio station, I feel that, you know, the people, you're going to turn off some people that you really don't want to turn off.
Right.
Even if it's a regular thing done by a comedian?
Yeah, I'm the comedian, and I've been doing it, so I'll take responsibility for it. I think some of them have been kind of funny. Have you heard any of them?
No, I haven't yet. I just heard the comment from my brother last night.
And he's a pastor. Well, I can understand how a guy who does devotionals, you know, as part of his job, would find it offensive. But I think that you might be undermining the comedic intent of it.
Yeah, you might want to listen to one and then make up your own mind.
Okay.
All right.
Right on, Alan.
I'll do that.
Thanks for calling, buddy.
That. Thanks a lot for calling. You know,
bye.
Alan. Thank you.
You know, it's interesting because this is kind of like the way some people reacted to the Passion of the Christ. They didn't see it, but they heard from other people
that it was
A, B, C, D, or E, and they reacted based on what they heard from other people.
I was one of those people until yesterday. And, you know, and I was happily disappointed by a lot of it.
But were you converted?
No, I did go home and thought, like, when I went back to my house after I, had seen it, and I was sitting by myself wondering what I was going to do with my day and just how sad my life was. I thought for a moment that, you know, it was nothing compared to, you know, what Jesus had to go through. Me just having to wonder, you know, what I'm going to do for dinner.
But I understand why somebody who is a preacher or even not a preacher, I understand why people who have religious beliefs might be offended by that.
I can see if they
don't find it funny, especially why they would find it.
And I also understand how the Passion of Christ would be so powerful to somebody who believed, you know, because, there's nothing like it, certainly. So we have Mitchell from Brooklyn on the line.
Hi.
Hi, Mitchell. How you doing?
I'm fine. What worries me is that no one's talking about, and I'm afraid is, and no one's doing anything about the possibility of a dirty bomb going off. We have irradiation plans for food, I'm told, all over the country. I don't know how many, but we certainly can't have a lot of security of those cobalt rods that are used there. And I'm told that you just have to take 10 sticks of dynamite and put them around a cobalt rod, and then 30 miles or 50 miles of New York City is unlivable for 30 years or more.
Well, Mitchell, can I just help you out a little bit? Here's my view. Having grown up in Europe and spent about half my life here and half my life there, knowing that there are possible terrorism attacks in the north part of Spain or the south or the northeast part of France or the southwest part of Spain or, you know, in the middle of London or in Ireland, they just don't stop me living my life. And I think that I don't know what the actual risks are, if we have any solid statistics from groups that really study this stuff and know how dangerous it can be. But I just think, you know, we can get hung up on being a bit paranoid here and live your life.
Yeah, sure.
Dude, I'm a little scared too, Mitchell. I'm on the train sometimes, and I'm like, isn't anyone looking out? Because, that bag is unattended.
Yeah, absolutely, unattended bags. But you become, you know, you do get some peripheral vision for that stuff. But I just think that I don't live my life every day worrying about any kind of attack. I mean, I have a friend who grew up in Northern Ireland, and she gave me this great piece of advice after 9/11. She was in Los Angeles when I was living there. And she said, you know what, you just have to figure at some point your number is up.
Hey. Why not use the police power to close down the irradiation plants, take all those pieces of cobalt, and make sure they are safe, or shoot them up into outer space, so we can reduce that risk.
I understand what you're saying, Mitchell, and I agree with you.
I don't at all.
You do?
I'm completely lost. I don't know anything about cobalt.
He's nervous about radioactive material getting into the wrong hands, and he'd like something to be done about it. Thanks for calling, Mitchell.
Are you an expert, Mitchell, or you just read about it?
No, he's scared.
I've just read about this.
Oh, okay. All right.
But I don't think anyone's doing anything about it.
You're probably right about that part.
Okay,
and
well, thanks.
And that's what we should be talking about or doing something about, and then talking about Ashcroft being an idiot.
Well, thanks for sharing the fear, and maybe somebody will get on that.
That's a great phrase. Thanks for sharing the fear.
Okay.
All right, Mitchell, take care.
John, Richmond, Virginia. John, are you there, buddy?
Yeah.
What's up, man?
I'm going to write that down.
I just wanted to talk a little bit about something that's been bothering me since the September 11th terrorist attack. The Bush administration had about 40 minutes in which they knew that hijacked planes were being crashed into buildings.
I know, man.
And
I know.
That a hijacked plane was headed towards D.C. and
right.
They did nothing at all to protect us.
Right. I don't. What do you think? What do you think that's about, John?
I don't know if it was intent or if it was incompetence, but it's obviously one or the other.
Like intentional negligence to allow it to happen
right.
would mean intent, and incompetence would mean there was just a bunch of people at the Pentagon having their coffee, going, "Has anyone called about that plane?"
Well, no. I mean, Bush himself had a window of opportunity in which he knew that hijacked planes were being crashed.
Well, maybe they were trying to assess it politically.
And he sat down and read stories to children rather than taking any action.
Well, maybe they were trying to assess it politically as to whether or not they could shoot down a passenger jet filled with Americans, even if it was heading for the Pentagon.
Well, even if they had, sent the planes up to escort it.
Right.
Andrews Air Force Base, I believe, is the one that's 10 minutes flight from D.C.
Yep.
And, take some action. Let us know that you're doing something. If you're going to claim to be strong on terrorism, you had a chance to demonstrate it. And instead, the Bush administration sat there and read stories to children.
I had a conversation with my friend yesterday about this very thing. It's just like, how could they even claim to be, ready or tough on terrorism if they couldn't even get the Air Force activated for almost an hour?
Yeah.
It's
John,
unbelievable.
I have three words for you, John, to explain my answer to your question. Hubris, arrogance, ignorance.
What about negligence?
But I don't know. I disagree, because I think Bush pulled this off for the longest time. Bush was a hero after September. It's not like everybody sat up and said, "What did you do for those 40 minutes?"
Well, we were in shock.
But the guy, we were out of shock by 2002. He had a 70% approval rating.
Right.
Yes, but that was just so blind. I think elsewhere in the world, he wasn't a hero at all. Everybody thought that the Americans
were
swept along with this kind of mindless worship of their commander in chief.
But Americans don't
People
care
were
about
amazed
what
at the lack of questioning by the U.S. public overall, and how people being brainwashed, and how Bush managed to take control by creating this idea of evil and terror and this kind of big abstract enemy
but
he was going to fight for you
but
all.
But you're dismissing the fact that we have never dealt with that kind of tragedy in this country.
I understand that
the level of fear that was existing in this country in those days, people really didn't know what to do.
No, and the leaders and the media exploited it.
That's absolutely true, but we can't blame people for being afraid.
I don't blame people for being afraid, but what there wasn't was any kind of incentive to actually calm people down and put it in perspective, and it was just manipulative to capitalize on that fear, which is absolutely human and universal.
Well, see,
everybody understood that. Everybody felt terrible. I mean, you had people coming, politicians and people in France saying, we are Americans now. Everybody felt this incredible sense of, communal sympathy for America.
No, but see, in New York, the day of September 11th, there was somebody that was a calming influence. And I hate to say this. I really hate to say this. But Rudy Giuliani.
Yeah, he showed up.
The mayor of New York City that day.
Well, it's one of those
more to calm people. And let me tell you something. I stepped out here at 4 o'clock that afternoon, on September 11th, and looked down Park Avenue South and saw a sea of people from 14th Street all the way up here, none of whom had any clue what they were going to do next.
So is that why I'm hearing, and you know, people whispering, oh, Rudy Giuliani for running mate. Well, Doug Cheney, get Giuliani.
I don't think it'll happen.
Well, no, it's not going to happen.
But Giuliani, it's amazing because, like, a tragedy on that level is something like a control freak really waits for. You know, it was a tremendous opportunity for him to really show how powerful he was.
You know, absolutely right. But he was a common.
But he was diplomatic. He was incredibly diplomatic.
Yeah,
he was incredibly
diplomatic, and he really did, in his own way, pull this city through this by being very calm. Now, mind you, he lost one of his closest people in the immediate aftermath.
Right.
I believe it was one of the chaplains for the fire department. So somebody he was very close to died not far from where he was,
right,
and he was still calm.
He was amazing. When him and Bush were at the site, you really, like, if you lived in New York, you were like, we know who's in charge.
Yeah, but I think that basically calm under pressure is a basic leadership skill. It's the same when, you know, if you're a parent and your child gets, you know, hit and is bleeding, you don't go, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. He goes, it's okay, everything's going to be fine.
You didn't know my mother.
It's basic. I mean, he did a great job, but frankly, it was obvious what to do.
Yeah, but not everybody always does it. Believe me.
It's time for the to some offensive morning devotional.
That's the offensive part.
Each day on Morning Sedition, we join hands and humbly ask the Heavenly Father for his guidance in the coming day. Today, Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak is visiting the president at his ranch in Crawford, Texas. Dear Lord, please guide our president in his meeting with the Egyptian president as they search for a solution to the thorny problems in the Middle East. For truly you are the Yahweh of the Jews, you are the Christian God, and you are the Allah to the Islamic peoples. You are the one true God of all peoples. Or you like covering your bets. I'm not one to judge. That would be you, big guy. Lord, the future of the Middle East is of vital importance to our president. Unfortunately, his apocalyptic vision of the future of the Middle East has a lot to do with you descending from on high with a flaming sword to smite the unbelievers with fiery vengeance. If you could, God, mellow that vision just a tad for the sake of those of us without a end-of-days mentality. For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory in a world without end. We ask this through Christ our Lord. Amen. This has been the Morning Devotional.
How come you're so sure he's a guy, by the way?
Because it's plainly obvious. It's in the book.
That's right.
I'm willing to entertain the idea that he's a woman. I once thought that, you know, yeah, maybe the universe is just a big womb. You know, I think that it would be an interesting practice to see, you know, God and spirituality as this giant womb where you have these churches that are sort of half circles that look like a pregnant stomach, and you enter the church to these large sort of, you know, vaginal-like flaps.
You know what? I was just about to embark on a kind of a sensible discussion on this, and it's already gone way
out
of control.
You should have known better. Coming up on Morning Sedition, the Alamo bites the dust. Bush's best defense is a good offense. Plus, the air marshal who lost her gun. We'll tell you where. All this and more on Air America Radio.
Today, we'll find out what Joe Klein has to say about Condoleezza Rice and his new column in Time Magazine. Plus, a resurrection at the box office that I was part of. I helped in that what would you call that, a revolt? No, and I don't know. My friends, I got friends. I have a couple friends. I do. I swear I do. I swear.
You're
I
sure.
Do. Yeah, but my friends.
We want proof, Mark.
I'll have one of them.
I've seen
come
them
in.
Talking on
Bring
the
him
cell
in.
Phone to a couple.
Yeah, I talk to people on my phone. The way I do it is that, you know, I have one. I really just have a couple of friends. I have the main guy, and then I have the guy I go to when I drain the main guy. You know what I mean? When I exhaust him of his emotional resources, I got the go-to guy. You know, the number two guy.
When you take up all the air in the room.
Yeah, and my buddy Sam's the main guy, and then I go to, you know, my buddy Jack, or a couple, maybe there's one other one, and Jack will be like, what, Sam tired?
Don't need him on different time zones. You need the New York one, and then, you know, for the very end of the day, everybody always needs the L.A. friend. The last person you can whine to at midnight, because they're always up.
I call him sometimes when I wake up. Phil the painter. He's a calming influence.
Oh, yeah, you mentioned him the
other day, yeah. Yeah, he's always sort of like, what's the matter, buddy?
Yeah, because it's only midnight out there, right?
What's up, buddy?
I can give you some friends in London, because you can reach them when you're up at 2 in the morning, as we are, because they're up at 7.
I got to be honest with you, Sue.
You don't want any London friends, do
the
you?
The English.
Oh, I knew it. It only took him 2 weeks.
The English,
I just knew it.
The last thing the English seem to be prepared to really deal with is a neurotic, self-centered American Jewish guy. You know, I just like, I don't feel like there's going to be a lot of love coming there. Like, I don't like that stiff upper lip stuff. If I'm having a crisis, it's a global crisis. Do you understand? When Mark is in trouble.
They go well together. They go well together, the kind of, you know, stoic kind of British thing.
Yeah,
with
but
let it all hang out neurotic thing.
See, then big baby Mark doesn't get his needs met. You know,
the dude is like tongue and groove. It's perfect.
Oh, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe I'm needing the wrong things. Because my wife is sort of like that. Yesterday I called her. I'm like, you know what? I don't know what I'm doing. What's going, you know? And she's like, you know what? Call me back when you're less insecure.
Absolutely. Good for her.
And I go, who do you want me to call? All right, I'll stay on the phone. Yeah. And then she just quieted down, and eventually, you know, after a series of phone calls. Do you ever do that where you do the one, you know, blast out phone call, right?
Yeah.
Then you hang up, and you're like, oh, I'm an idiot. Then you call back and do the first sort of like, sorry, I'm an idiot phone call. Do you still love me? Don't hate me. All right. And then you hang up and do the one last one. Really? I really?
Thank goodness for unlimited minutes on cell phones.
I know. I don't know how you need that
major insecurity calling plan. Do you still love me calling plan?
Yeah. I'm revealing too much about myself.
I go exactly in the opposite direction.
You do?
I do. I start out like real angry and like, and then get progressively mellower.
Well, that's what I did.
Is that what you did?
Yeah. I mean, eventually you're sort of like, all right, I'm okay. Yeah, I don't know what happened. I had a brain skid.
It's just like dealing with kids. You just have to let them exhaust themselves.
Hey, wait.
Finally, they all take a nap.
Did you just call me? Are you saying I'm immature?
No. I just said it was like.
Have some candy.
How about some Haagen-Dazs?
Okay.
Okay, onward and upward, you guys.
Enough about me.
Yes, enough about you. Former FBI Chief Louis Free and former Attorney General Janet Reno have something in common today with the current Attorney General, John Ashcroft. All three are preparing to testify tomorrow before the commission investigating the September 11th attacks.
It was his fault. No, it wasn't. It was his fault.
Right. Unlike them, though, President Bush would do so behind closed doors. Are we surprised? Mm-hmm. Yesterday, he answered questions about the presidential daily briefing from August 6th, 2001 that was released under some duress and after much prompting by the 9/11 commission over the weekend. Here's some of what he said.
The PDB was no indication of a terrorist threat. There was not a time and place of an attack. And it was, that said, Osama bin Laden had designs on America. Well, that PDB said nothing about an attack on America.
But he had designs on America. So that it had nothing about an attack, just sort of an idea.
Designs, folks, okay? It's not clear which part of the PDB Bush was saying nothing about an attack on America. It might have been the first sentence, which says, quote, Bin Laden, since 1997, has wanted to conduct terrorist, quote, attacks, unquote, in the U.S. Or maybe it was the part that says Al-Qaeda, quote, maintains a support structure that could aid, quote, attacks. Or, if you're still with me, the one that says a Bin Laden cell in New York was recruiting Muslim American youth for attacks. Anybody spot the recurrence of the word attacks here?
I did. I spotted it.
Go straight to the top of the class, Mark Maron.
Thank you.
Or the part where FBI information, quote, indicates patterns of suspicious activity in this country consistent with, wait for this, preparations for hijackings or other types of attacks. It's going to be embarrassing.
It happened again.
Wait a minute.
Sit down, please, Mark.
Sorry.
Let somebody else have a turn.
Can I have a cookie?
My turn.
Okay, yes, Mark. Riley?
Attacks.
Well done. And finally, it's possible the president was referring to the PDB's final sentence about a tip that, quote, a group of Bin Laden supporters was in the U.S. planning attacks with explosives.
Yeah, but that could have been like they were planning on doing it elsewhere. See, I understand how that one is trouble, because they could have been planning an attack in the U.S. on an outside country.
This is so amazing.
I'll forgive him for that one. He just didn't understand.
I mean, how vague are you allowed to be?
How many Al-Qaeda cells are still left in this country? Does anybody think we've cleaned them all out?
Including the two in my building?
September
11th? Oh, I'm kidding.
No, I mean, there really has to be a very serious question asked here. You know, there was all of this intelligence about Al-Qaeda cells inside the U.S.
Right.
Let's assume for a moment they didn't all kill themselves hijacking these airplanes. What happened to the rest of them?
They're waiting. We all know that Osama bin Laden spends many, many years planning attacks.
Well, a lot of them seem to be going to strip clubs and drinking and, you know, learning how to fly planes and stuff. But I guess that's not happening anymore. I'm not sure what they're doing.
Isn't it amazing that they can dodge and dodge and yet dodge again over and over on the fact that they say there were no specifics? I mean, it's all, every time you see a quote from anybody defending the White House position, it's always that, as Bush said himself, that they, he didn't know there was going to be an attack on America, as he said, at a time and place.
Am
every
I missing
time you
something?
See a quote, it's all about the 9/11 attack. Well, if you've had all this information that we've just heard now about attacks and preparations for hijackings and Muslim American youth being recruited by Bin Laden's cell for attacks, don't you think it's your job as president or anybody who works for him in national security to go and find some specifics? You've been given all the general information. Isn't it your job to go and kind of nail it?
Well, it seems that there were so many of them out there that had specifics, but they just didn't have each other's cell phone number, apparently. In the FBI, that seemed to be the big problem.
The other thing that really gets me is all this stuff about there being no actionable intelligence and how they knew all this stuff, but nothing was specific, so they couldn't actually act on it.
Actionable.
Actionable, as opposed to general. So this is all general, they're saying, and it wasn't actionable, so they couldn't take action because it wasn't specific. Have you read anywhere the word Iraq in any of this stuff? I haven't.
I haven't either.
So,
and I didn't hear you
somehow,
say that. I heard you say attack
you
many
did.
A time.
And my pronunciation may be bad for Americans, but I wasn't saying Iraq or Iraq.
You know what I think is the most delicious irony in all of this?
Delicious?
Delicious.
You mean in
irony.
A schadenfreude kind of ice cream flavor way?
There you go. Butter pecan.
Yeah. Talgadas is schadenfreude.
Are you sure it's not kind of sweet and sour? There's a nasty bitter thing going on here?
No, it's a delicious irony.
Okay.
The Bush administration spent all that time trying to link Al-Qaeda and Iraq in the minds of most Americans. Saddam had something to do with the attack. And now Al-Qaeda and Iraq have been linked in a way that the Bush administration never expected.
I know,
last week's situation.
He's created a terrorist manufacturing plant.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and the thing is, you've got, on the one hand, people asking questions about what happened on September 11th and what the administration knew about Al-Qaeda. And on the other hand, Iraq is going up in flames.
Yeah.
This is not what he planned.
It couldn't have been. Can I ask you a question, Sue?
Yes.
What is it in, how does he get off on saying that he had no information when all that information is there? Is there a semantic issue? Is there a language issue? Is it all about him saying they didn't mention 9/11 specifically still?
I think it's partly that. I think that's what they're hiding behind. Let me just read this one sentence again, because I think it comes up three different times, that the whole language issue. Maybe we could get somebody on to kind of parse his language. I am satisfied that I never saw any intelligence that indicated there was going to be an attack on America struck this whole sentence. I am satisfied. I never saw, but did you read or hear, there was going to be an attack. Well, there wasn't an attack. There were several in one day. But the most important thing is their constant refuge in the specific language at a time and place. I mean, you read that.
That's how he hypnotizes people. They're confused at his bad grammar and his inability to make a point properly. And they just, automatically
agree with
it. They
might be. It's absolutely, but they're using it now. They're working it. It's like, what's the Clinton thing again? What's the definition of I or is or?
Right, right.
Or sex or?
Yeah, I didn't know it was her mouth.
When we come back, who won the battle between strategists and tacticians in the Bush White House? Joe Klein will give us the lowdown. Plus, family lottery or numbers racket? You decide here on Air America Radio.
Air America Radio. We're not Fox, period.
I'm Mark Riley with Mark Maron and Sue Ellicott on Air America Radio. So, folks, no harm, no foul. I don't know about New York, but maybe in Cleveland.
What are you talking about, man?
A federal air marshal left her gun in a ladies' room at Hopkins International Airport.
Nice.
All right, and of course,
talk about that moment of panic, man. When I don't know where my wallet is for 3 minutes, I'm like, "What's going? Where? Oh my God!" Because you imagine like that moment, where you're like, "I don't have my machine gun."
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
I'm a bit worried for America that we can't teach federal marshals to pee and pack heat at the same time.
Oh,
why
come
does he
on,
have to take
on.
It off?
It's a human oversight, you know what I mean? Let's have a little sympathy for the poor woman. Probably had other things on her mind.
This is a record. I'm going to write this down. First time Mark Maron showed compassion. On air, compassion.
No,
I mean, it's the like day you, after he sees the passion of the Christ,
you got, you got,
this film really changed you,
right? It
you,
did, right?
You have, you are seeing the light.
I mean, she, you know, so she probably was like, oh man, I got to go to work, and I, you know what I mean? Like my husband yelled at me this morning, or my lover, or whatever her background is, and you know, sometimes you set things on the counter. Better yet, could you imagine the person that came in next, not knowing what to do? Like, is that a gun?
Well,
is that
a gun?
It was found by
actually. No, but that poor guy walks out of the bathroom holding the gun because he found it. You know, imagine if they took him. That, all right, get down. No, I found it. Sure, you did. You're under arrest.
Yep. That, I mean, there was that possibility. Fortunately, the passenger that found the gun told an airport worker who called the cops, and the lady picked up the heat a little while later.
Did they announce something like paging? Paging person who's left a gun in the ladies'
federal
room.
Air marshal.
With the person who left a semi-automatic weapon in the ladies' room, please. Pick up a white courtesy phone. We have your weapon.
So, here's the latest from the box office wars. Top of the heap, as Mark Maron.
Top of the top of the junk heap is Alamo.
Well, yeah. The Passion did what 17 point something million dollars, and did quite well. The biggest disappointment of the weekend, as Mark very correctly points out, is the Alamo, the big movie that couldn't.
Remember the maybe not.
Right,
remember to wait for DVD.
The $100 million epic, and I use that term very loosely. Was tied for third place, I believe it was $9.2 million, and it was tied for third place with the Johnson Family Vacation, which was the thing with Cedric the Entertainer, all right? Now, the Alamo cost $100 million.
Yeah.
Cedric's flick cost $12
million. Right.
They both grossed the same amount of money.
Yeah.
You tell me who's feeling good, Fox or Disney.
Yeah, I guess that would be Fox, right? That's the right answer, right?
Yeah,
the answer, right?
I would say Fox.
Oh, man,
Fox
that's two
right
for me
answer.
Today. I got attacked, and I answered that question. Yeah.
There you go. Another week, and they'll make their money back on Cedric's flick. I don't know how long they'll be. I think the Alamo will be on DVD.
It's very hard to imagine how anybody wanted to pour that kind of money into the Alamo, because nobody outside America wants to see that.
Well, I would imagine that the Mexican population is not that excited
maybe
about that.
Maybe someone didn't tell them that the Latinos are now the, kind of the largest
they do win,
minority
right?
Yeah.
In the
U.S.
Yeah, they do win.
But ultimately, in the long haul, they didn't win.
It sounds terrible. It sounds really boring. I had much more fun. I took my kids to see a German vaudeville cabaret with people who played table tennis by spitting the balls across a table.
And
Well, I think, is that, I saw an adult version of that once.
It was very adult. The great thing about it was that you would have enjoyed it.
No, the one that I saw, they were nude, and the balls were coming out of someplace else.
Yeah.
This was close.
Yeah?
Really?
This was close.
What'd your kids think of it?
At one point, one of them turned to me and said, I thought this was supposed to be for children.
Really?
Because they thought it was too sexy.
They're actually censoring themselves, like
there
mom.
There was a very incredibly sexy female gymnast who was, sort of, you know, who was writhing around the stage in a sort of black kind of strappy kind
your kid?
Of bondage outfit.
How old's your kid?
1 7, 1 5.
Which one said that?
The 7-year-old.
Oh, you're in trouble.
But he got really into the slapstick stuff. No, it was interesting.
But he saw the half-naked woman and said, oh, no, this is horrible.
No, he didn't think it was horrible. But on the other hand, my 5-year-old on the left was like clapping like mad.
Oh, really?
He's like, yeah, yeah, more,
yeah, yeah,
more.
Yeah.
Uh-oh. He's going to be the one you're going to have to watch out for.
But it was good. It was a very European kind of show, and as much as it was funny and slapstick and silly and goofy and completely appealed to children's sense of the absurd.
You mean not that great?
But no, but was also incredibly sexy for adults.
So it's all ages. That's good.
You would have liked it. I actually thought of
What's
you
it
while
called?
I was there. It's called Vivace.
Vivace?
Vivace.
V-I-V-A-C-E. Vivace.
It's Italian, Mark.
No, no, I'm completely open to embracing the arts and crafts of people from around the world.
Particularly women in black bondage outfits.
You would have
liked it. I thought, if only Mark Maron had come here, he could see that.
I'm not a bondage guy. I kind of like just, you know, women who maybe look a little sad.
Oh, no.
You were the kind of guy that used to hang out in front of the Port Authority bus terminal here in New York and just...
Well, no, I didn't. Girls that are coming off the bus,
got no train fare.
It's weird because my wife is such a, like a butch, kind of like, you know, dominatrix-y.
She is
not.
She's beautiful and feminine. We've seen her.
No, but in behavior, I mean, she can kick my ass. She really, I mean, physically, she could kick my ass.
Good.
Oh, my goodness.
I like her already.
Well, someone needs to get their ass kicked in Flint, Michigan. Some kids found more than eggs.
Plenty of people have already, unfortunately.
Yeah, right? Well, there were Easter egg hunts all over America on the weekend.
Yeah.
And in Flint, Michigan, what did they find? Two loaded handguns, a BB gun, and a broken toy gun. What kind of, outside the doors of an elementary.
What kind of school is this? They continued the dig, and they found a bunker and several people living inside from World War II.
But nobody was injured, right?
No. Okay, I guess that we go back to no harm, no foul. You know, just
and
like
the gun went off, didn't it? One of the guns go off, but not with a kid.
Yeah. I think it was the BB gun. Somebody dropped it and went off when
did you have a BB gun when you were a kid?
For a minute.
My parents wouldn't let me have
it. Until my parents found out I had it. I got it and then hid it for a while.
My buddy had a pellet gun, and we wreaked havoc with that thing, man. You ever see what a pellet gun can do to a phone booth? It just shatters. There's probably a warrant out for me from high school.
Yeah, now where did you grow up? Because I think they want to bill
you. Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Yeah, I'm sure they want to bill you. Anyway, you're right. There was no harm. No one was shot.
I just had a good idea. If a kid's looking for Easter eggs in Michigan can find loaded Howe guns, how about we send them into Iraq to see if they can find weapons of mass destruction?
Children? Uh-oh.
Well, if they found this without even trying, let's just see, you know, this will be the final test whether WMDs actually exist.
Okay, I'll go with you on that, Sue. That sounds like a very good idea. And you said it.
Uh-huh.
I'm not going to, I'm going to support her on her funny idea.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Mark, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Mark.
And in Recovery Corner, I reach out to fellow 12-steppers who are struggling to stay clean and sober. Today, I'm offering counsel to one George W., was in his fifth day, sadly, of isolation in Crawford, Texas. And, George, I think it's time to come on out of the ranch and sort of accept some responsibility. I mean, clearly, as Sue said earlier, the word attack was in there like 6 or 7 times, and it said U.S. 5 or 6 times. And I know maybe it's unclear to you, but, you got to take responsibility. You missed it. You missed the ball on this one. And also, maybe it's time to make an amends. To make a list of the people you've harmed, including the, thousands of Iraqis and soldiers from here who are not alive anymore, and maybe make an amends to those people. And also, take it easy. First things first, do the next right thing and try and stay sober today. Remember, if you're not drinking, it's good. Yeah, that's it.
Well, that's been
Recovery Corner, a kind of loose Recovery Corner.
He does have some apologizing to do.
Yeah.
I mean, he was down in Fort Hood in Texas yesterday. He visited 11 injured soldiers from that base, which has the largest number of combat troops in Iraq right now.
This is the first time, though, he did this publicly, right?
He went to meet 11 people, and he handed out 10 Purple Hearts for injury. I mean, how would that feel to be the 11th guy, one who didn't get anything?
Why was the 11th guy left out?
Good question.
Was he just a little stressed?
Yeah, he was scratched.
Yeah.
I think that was mean.
Bad week.
Anyway, we have to go. Still ahead, we're going to let you talk with columnist and author Joe Klein. Give us a ring at 866-303-AARZERO. That's 866-303-2270. But first, the headlines.
With Sue Ellicott and Mark Maron, I'm Mark Riley on Air America Radio. Joining us now is Time Magazine columnist and the author of Primary Colors, Joe Klein, whose column in today's edition of Time Magazine focuses on the hearings before the September 11th panel. Joe Klein, good morning.
Hi, good morning, Mark. I feel safe in saying Mark because you're both Mark, right?
How you
Absolutely.
Doing, Joe?
How
Just
you doing?
Wait till I talk, though.
I'm Mark with a C.
Yeah, and I'm Mark with a K. Joe Klein, let me ask you, looking at your piece, you seem to kind of divide the inner circle of the Bush White House into strategists and tacticians. Why do you think the strategists won out?
Because there weren't any tacticians.
Could you explain the difference a little bit just for our listeners between...
These are wonky words that policy people in Washington use all the time. Condi Rice used them, all the time when she testified last Thursday. Strategy is kind of big think, intellectual, long-term planning.
Like missile defense system kind of stuff?
Well, yeah, that's part of the strategy.
Like we're going to rule the world kind of stuff?
Like we're going to remake the Middle East in our image
sort of
stuff.
Got it.
The wonderful thing about strategy, especially in this administration, is that you can do it in one word, like containment during the Cold War, appeasement during the 30s. Those are strategies.
Right.
Unilateralism.
Right.
A strategy.
Right.
Tactics are kind of more, blue collar. Those are the practical decisions and practical detail work that you face in implementing a strategy or in responding to an event. You know, how are you going to respond when they blow up the USS Cole? And you know, the Clinton administration was very tactical. Didn't have a grand overriding strategy, in part because the world had just changed, and the Cold War was over, so you couldn't really tell what the threats were going to be. Clinton could be faulted, you know, in his second term when it became very apparent that we were facing a real challenge from Al-Qaeda for not developing a strategy. That's what Dick Clark was so ticked off about during the Clinton administration. He doesn't cop to it now, but he was as angry then as he is now. And he was really angry about the fact that the president and the leaders of the foreign policy team during Clinton weren't coming up with a grand strategy for fighting Al-Qaeda. The Bush administration's been the total opposite. They came in with this grand plan. He filled his administration with neoconservatives who are strategic thinkers, who don't have any practical experience at all for the most part.
What is their grand strategy, those guys, in your head?
Well, in my head, their grand strategy, was to remake, you know, the Middle East, by taking out Iraq. They believed in something called the benign domino theory.
Yeah.
That if, and you've seen a little bit of it happen. I mean, that if you took out Iraq, everybody else would be intimidated, and countries like Libya and Syria and Saudi Arabia and Iran would moderate.
So they thought if they were to, you know, to show force in that area, the grand strategy of fighting terrorism would just be all the other countries would go, well, we're not going to do nothing.
Right. Or, you know, we're going to be more democratic, or we're going to open up. You know, they thought that Iran would, that the reform movement in Iran, which has now collapsed, would carry the day. But I got to say, the most important thing here was that ultimately this would protect Israel. It would, that was a very important thing, and it was also important that you were setting up an alternative, source of oil. Because, you know, there is a fair amount of fear that the Saudi government is pretty shaky. So this was all this big think without actually thinking about the details of what, you know, overthrowing Iraq would be.
So basically, Joe, it sounds like you're saying, so the benign domino theory, it's kind of like the we are right theory, which is what Bush said this weekend. He came out this weekend on his ranch and said, we are right. No matter what's happening in Iraq, they keep on bellowing this out, don't they, that we are right.
Well, that's their strategy, I guess.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, that's a simple way of putting it. But I think that in this case, you know, strategic thinking is great, but without doing the detail work, without doing the real, tough tactical thinking, strategies are just pipe dreams.
Well, it sounds as though strategic thinking is just basically delaying, and the tactical thinking is actually doing something.
Not true, Sue. In 1949, when the United States came up with containment as a strategy to stop the spread of communism, it was matched with all kinds of detailed responses across the board.
Mm-hmm.
Some were stupid, like Vietnam. Others were really smart. In this case, there has been no detailed thinking. These guys didn't give 3 seconds of thought to the difference between a Sunni and a Shiite, and they're paying the price for it. It was an act of arrogance beyond imagining, and one of the greatest mistakes, I think, it'll go down as one of the greatest mistakes in the history of American foreign policy.
Let me ask you, Joe Klein, where do the tacticians in an administration usually come from? We know where the strategic thinkers came from in the Bush administration. Do tacticians come from the military? Where do they come from?
Well, there are a lot of military tacticians, but there are also, you know, the people you want are the inspired bureaucrats like Dick Clark. I mean, Dick Clark was essentially a tactician. If you say to him, give me a plan for remaking the Middle East, you know, he'll say, what? But if you tell him, how do we get the lights turned on in Baghdad within a week after we take over the place, he'll come up with a plan.
But presumably the inspired bureaucrats can sometimes not mesh with the politics that...
Well, usually they don't. There's usually a creative tension between the big thinkers and the detailed thinkers. But, you know, the interesting thing about this terrorist problem that we're facing is that it's so complicated and it's so diffuse that this should be the salad days of the tacticians. You know, this is the sort of thing where you can't come up with an overall strategy. You have to just keep, the overall strategy is let's just keep after this.
Vigilance.
Keep on trying to roll up the cells. You know, when there are going to be times when you have to use special forces to take out something, and there are going to be times when you use the police forces to take out something. But it's total vigilance. It's staying on top of things. And as we've seen, this is not something that President Bush likes to do. He has said that nuance is his least favorite word. And in this case, you know, take the events of the weekend, the August 6th memo. You know, Bush's defenders say, well, you know, there's nothing specific in there, but, you know, if he were more detail oriented, he would have said, wait a second, there are 70 open field, you know, full field cases about Al-Qaeda. Could you guys just come back to me with a list of what they're investigating and, you know, and do it like by tomorrow? And by tomorrow you would have had, you know, the fact that they were involved in flight schools in a number of different places around the United States.
Well, I guess nuance doesn't really enable the sort of language that broad generalizing strategy can allow you. You know, it doesn't have the same selling points.
Well, also, it's a lot more, it takes a lot more work.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll give you another example of a guy who is detail-oriented. I think that the strongest performance during Bill Clinton's presidency was his yearly line-by-line negotiation of the details of the budget with the Republicans in Congress.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he'd get like $50 million more for Head Start or $75 million more for some form of environmental protection, and he knew every line of the budget. You know, that was, you know, the greatest strength of the Clinton presidency, and it's the greatest weakness of the Bush presidency.
Interesting. We'll be right back with Joe Klein and you on the telephones at 866-303-AAR0. That's 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Air America Radio. Talk radio you don't have to yell at.
We're back with Time Magazine columnist Joe Klein, and we'll be taking your calls at 866-303-AAR0. And that's 866-303-2270. This is Mark Maron with Sue and Mark Riley. And we got Joe Klein on the line for your calls. And right now we're going to go to John in the suburbs of Chicago. John, how are you?
John, hey, how are you today?
I'm pretty good. Do you have a question for Joe Klein?
Actually, no, it's a different subject. It was an earlier subject.
Well, I bet you Joe Klein could say something about it.
Yep.
Okay. You had an earlier caller. He mentioned the cobalt rods used for food irrigation, and he had a concern about
yes.
that. And you guys kind of dismissed him, and I didn't think that was proper because this guy's thinking out of the box. He's thinking like a terrorist thinks, and that's the kind of thinking the CIA and the FBI need to use to protect us.
I think you're right. I didn't mean it to sound like we dismissed him. It's just there was no way I could solve his immediate problem, and I did think that it was important to get that issue out there. And I think you're right. That is the way that the FBI should and the CIA should think out of the box, and maybe even try to talk to each other occasionally.
All right.
Exactly. If you guys want some real good tips on fighting the terrorists, ask a plumber or an electrician or a machinist, because we think out of the box all the time. Believe me.
We're gonna send that message to the intelligence community now.
Thanks, John.
Right.
Send
Thanks,
us some
John.
Questions, and we'll go to Evan. I don't know where Evan is, but Evan has a question for Joe Klein. Evan.
Evan, good morning.
Good day to you, Evan.
Good day to you. I just was wondering why everyone seems to be overlooking the fact that we had more information in the PDB on August 6th than we ever had against Iraq before we invaded there and sent 150,000 troops over there.
That's good. We raised that point a little bit earlier. I did say that I think we didn't see the word Iraq once in any of those.
Well,
Joe Klein, maybe you've got a good answer for that.
No, it's you know, it's amazing how much faith they had in the information they had about Iraq. We had a lot of information about Iraq, and you know, the problem was that it was all wrong, and most of it came from Ahmed Shalabi and his family and friends. I mean, you know, that was the big problem. Did you guys ever see the, you know, the movie The Tailor of Panama?
No.
Or read the book.
Remember, Le Carre, right?
It was, you know, Jeffrey Rush played this tailor in Panama who, you know, was recruited by a British spy. And the tailor needed some money, so he kept on telling stories about a coup that was coming and nearly caused an international war. Ahmed Shalabi is the tailor of Iraq.
Just remind me, he is the Iraqi exile, very wealthy. He was the sort of the chosen man by the administration to take over, and he lived in exile in London for many, many years.
By the way, this is a name that every listener to this network should be familiar with. And yesterday on the Stephanopoulos program, Richard Pearl, who is one of the leading neoconservatives, said two or three more times that we should have turned over Iraq to Ahmed Shalabi, who has absolutely no following there, only has a following among neoconservatives here, and was also the guy who fed us all this ridiculous information, these lies about weapons of mass destruction.
But isn't that how the business used to be run in the Cold War, or is that they'd set a guy up who they liked, who was, you know, had the American interest in mind, and they just, you know, propped him up and defended his administration in whatever country they put him in?
Well, that was that only worked in small countries that were actual countries. Here you have in Iraq a big country that isn't really a country. It's actually three different ethnic groups that have never really gotten along without, you know, someone really cracking the whip, and it's a completely different era.
Yeah.
You know, it's a moment where, you know, radical Islam is very much on the rise, and America's never been very popular in that part of the world. It's not like taking over Guatemala.
Yeah. Let's go next to Patrick, who's calling us from the great Bronx, New York. Patrick, good morning.
Good morning. How do you feel this morning?
All right, how you doing?
I got to tell you this. Now, check this out. I was watching Tucker Carlson on Crossfire.
I'm sorry.
Hello?
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
We're listening.
And Al Franken was happened to be on. This was a week and a half ago, just before your big preview.
Uh-huh.
And they were scoffing at him because he only had six radio stations. Now, I said to myself, an idea is a greater monument than any cathedral. And just like the Iraq war, the Republicans underestimated Iraq. Right-wing radio underestimated Air America. Now, you can actually see how it's taking off.
Well, thank you very much.
What I'm trying to say is that now you were talking about weapons of mass destruction, and you used the metaphor before as children. What we should do, just like you say, just like when you have a bottle of aspirin that you can't open, who do you give it to? A child.
Not in my house.
You send the children to Iraq, and they will find the weapons of mass destruction.
Well,
because obviously, what we have here is a complete calamity.
You're right, but I will say, I just wanted just to nail this point, that I was being a little bit flippant when I said that. I was just trying to make a point.
Don't you think they're scoffing at Air America? They actually think, like, it's not going to take off. But don't they? People are thinking human beings. We are not stupid. Americans ain't as stupid as people think we are.
Okay, well, on that point,
we're
going to
use that as a promo.
I agree with you about that.
I have a question for Joe Klein, actually, on this. Joe, as a columnist for Time, maybe you can answer this one. There is a poll in the recent edition that says that 48% of Americans believe that the Bush administration did all it could to prevent the 9/11 attacks. Now, we have seen all sorts of information come out of the commission over the last couple of weeks. We had the presidential daily briefing published at the weekend, along with a 1.5-page rebuttal or explanation by the administration that didn't really hold water. Are you surprised by that number, that almost half of Americans still believe the administration did all it could to prevent 9/11?
Well, two-thirds of Americans still believe that the war was, that we were right to go to war in Iraq. I mean, look, two things. First of all, about polling, especially when the numbers are in the 40s or the 30s or so, don't believe this crap. I mean, you know, polling is the crack cocaine of political journalists and politicians.
There's no way it can be true, right? I mean,
well, no,
just
but,
numbers.
You know, when 90% of the people who pollsters call hang up the phones,
how reliable can this stuff be?
Yeah, who are those people that have to talk to pollers?
When you get an 80-20 result, when you see that 90% of the American, 97% of the American people believe that it's not right to kill your neighbor, you could pretty much trust that.
I have never been polled. Have you ever been polled at home?
That's because you hang up on
them. Right? Well, actually, I have been polled once. I forget what it was for, and I didn't hang up on them. I'm just a jerk in that way. But the second thing is this. Polling on issues like the war, and I would even say like gay marriage, I think is notoriously insufficient, because people's feelings about these subjects are very, very, very complicated, and I think asking them yes or no questions, just doesn't get to that kind of complication. In this, and also you have a lot of factors that things trickle down, especially when they are complicated. The notion that Bush could have done more, that there were things that he might have known. It's going to take some time to trickle down. But I do think that these things also work synergistically. His performance on 9/11 isn't helping the way people feel about his performance in Iraq. It's raising more and more and more questions. And so you see, gradually the numbers drift down, in terms of approval or confidence in his ability to do foreign policy. So, to look at one number like that at a moment when that story really is pretty new in the American mind, is to take the wrong message out of this.
We're talking to Joe Klein, columnist for Time magazine, and we're taking your calls for him at 866-303-AAR0. That's 866-303-2270. Joe, we have Evelyn on the line for you.
Hello.
Good morning.
Hello. This is in line with what Sue Ellicott was saying. Do you think that the Bush administration is going to be able to ride out this whole business with this August 6th PDB that is so damaging?
That's an interesting question. Is it going to stick to him, Joe Klein?
Yes.
Well, I think that, I don't think that it's that. I think that they have, they managed to smudge the reply as they did with Richard Clark. I mean, the distressing thing about what's going on in this country right now is that almost everything immediately becomes partisan. Clark's testimony, where the facts of what he was saying have been disputed by no one. No one. And yet, within a couple of weeks, you had one of those 80-20 poll answers that I was talking about. 80% of the Bush supporters didn't believe Clark, and 80% of Kerry supporters did. And so the same is going to be true with this PDB. I think that, 80% of Bush supporters are going to say, well, it wasn't specific enough. And 80% of Kerry supporters are going to say, wow, why the hell didn't he do something?
But didn't it look amazing, Joe, that they had to put out they couldn't just let the briefing stand on its own. They put out a statement that was 1.5 times the length of the original statement,
trying to
interpret it for the public.
I think that a Democratic administration would have done the same thing.
Oh, really? Okay.
Under the circumstances.
Fair enough.
But I do believe that, it's astonishing that they've had to put it out. It's astonishing, the way that they respond to these things, they assume not the ignorance of the American people, but just the fact that that folks aren't, don't get interested in the details. They figure that they could toss it away by saying, oh, it's just a historical document, and for the vast majority of Americans, that'll be enough. And you know what? Before September 11th, it was enough. I think we're living in a completely different era right now. It's something that I would hope that the Kerry campaign will catch up to as well. But my guess is that people are far more serious about our public life right now than they were before.
There's so much information out there. So many people get their information almost secondhand. They don't even go to the source. They just listen to what's a soundbite that someone repeats on the street or who they talk to, and that's what they believe.
Yeah, and some of us get most of our information from John Stewart.
Wasn't that amazing that Condoleezza Rice could call that document historical? I mean, historic I could understand, but historical?
Well, hysterical.
Yeah, hysterically historic.
But even the idea that you couldn't learn anything from history, that's ridiculous.
But no one's called her on it. I just feel like sending her a dictionary.
But to square the circle here, this was another case where you had tactical information that you could act on, but the Bush administration didn't act on it because there was no great strategy in place for dealing with Al-Qaeda. They didn't think of Al-Qaeda as a major threat.
Joe Klein, thank you so very, very much for joining us. I'm sorry that we're out of time. Joe Klein, columnist for Time Magazine, thank you.
My pleasure.
You take care.
Take it easy.
In the final hour of Morning Sedition, the latest from Iraq, you on the telephones, plus the liberal agenda. This is Air America Radio, serving malcontents and rabble-rousers since 2004. Good morning. I'm Mark Riley, along with Sue Ellicott and Mark Maron, here on Air America Radio. It's 7 minutes past the hour, and this is Morning Sedition. Today, you've got to be in it to win it, but that doesn't mean you start your own lottery. And why are college professors such punching bags for politicians? That's all ahead, but right now, I've got Sue Ellicott and Mark Maron with me.
Hello.
Again,
hello.
Still, since 6 this morning.
Still.
We're
since
still
5
here.
This morning.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
We're not going anywhere.
Yeah. We're not going anywhere.
Yeah, no. Do you ever suffer from depression?
Sure.
Fleetingly.
Sure.
Just fleeting?
Yeah, I usually have to go outdoors and look at trees or the sea or river or go on a bike ride. I use nature to cure depression.
Yeah, I don't...
I used to use drugs.
I've tried them. You mean recreational drugs?
Whatever.
I hear what you're saying. The weird thing about antidepressants is that, you know, like Prozac used to be sold on the idea that it will change your personality.
Mm-hmm.
And it does, but it doesn't remove the old one.
No,
you know what I mean? It's sort of like you've got this new one, but the old one's still locked in there. You've got this new one walking around going, I feel great, but the other guy's going, let me out. This pill-popping freak is taking me hostage. I don't believe in depression. I think that if someone says to you, you might be clinically depressed, you should say, really? Well, thank you. That means I'm awake. Is there any indication we shouldn't be depressed? Are we living on the same planet, me and you? You ever think that depression might be the, you know, the reasonable response to the stuff we're going through as a species, meant to propel us into the next evolutionary step? Maybe it's the people that are happy all the time that are really sick in the head.
You're
maybe
just saying that being happy is stupid in the giving in the age
stupid.
That we're living
I didn't
in.
Stupid. I
ignorant?
Didn't say stupid. Not even ignorant. I said sickness. It's a sickness. Maybe it's those people like, hey, how's it going? I don't know. I feel great again. Well, that's creepy and weird. Maybe you need medication. Clearly you're self-centered, narcissistic. I don't know what's wrong with you, but you're draining me with your happy. Could you move along? I'm doing the big work here.
I'm the heavy lifting guy.
Big mental heavy lifting. But I think that...
What will the drug companies do if your world? I mean, you know, if you don't.
They make it. Here's what they do, Mark. They make up syndromes. They're already doing it because the depression pills they're not like Zoloft used to treat depression.
I know.
Right. So now it's trickling off apparently because they're now advertising Zoloft also treats social anxiety disorder. You mean shyness?
Oh, I saw that. I saw
you know
that.
I mean, they're just making
that's
up.
That's right. Yeah, the guy sitting in all in the corner.
Yeah, but what is that? That's not a sickness. And it's sort of like if you look at the breakdown of any psychological condition, there's so many of them. They're so broad. You're going to have at least two of them.
That's
you ever
just
read the
phase.
Symptoms?
That's
you ever
all
read it? It's sort of like, are you uncomfortable with sushi? Yeah, I am a little bit. Do you sing in your car? I do. Maybe I have the. Maybe I need pills.
Do you watch porn in your car?
No, you can't watch porn in your car anymore. But all I'm saying is it's not easy for anybody. I don't think you need medicine. The only difference between disappointment and depression is your level of commitment.
Oh, well, I don't know. I think that depression, yeah, there clearly are clinically or chemically depressed people out there. But
I know, yeah.
In general, I'd say that Americans do take far too many pills and rely far too much on medicine.
And they eat too much.
I don't like pills anyway. Pills just, you know, well, if you get a headache, take this. If you get this, take this. I worked in a school once in a junior high school where all of the kids in special ed had to be medicated every day. It was like, and you had to be certified. They would not let these kids into class. These are junior high school kids, unless it could be certified that they had taken their Ritalin. And then they were surprised, shocked, and disappointed when one of the kids ended up selling bags of reefer.
But people here are brainwashed. When you come here from another country and you start, or you travel through America and you're in transit in an airport and you get those TV screens, you know, that they're blasting through ads on cable. You would think that this country, every single person had some kind of, you know, reflux, heartburn, depression, erectile dysfunction. It's just amazing.
Sue,
you can't believe there's any single sort of functioning person who's not popping pills or injecting themselves with something 24/7.
Just because we live in a country with a lot of people in it, you know, and it's not this small little quaint country like your Britain, you know, there's probably a lot more people that have those problems.
Yeah, but proportionally, there should be roughly the same money number, shouldn't
there? You're
telling
me there's no advertisements in England about acid reflux medicine?
Not to the same degree.
I mean, there's not as many companies?
No, there's just not as many huge, you know, huge drug companies pushing their products on people who are made to feel kind of frightened and ill and insecure and useless without them. It's all advertising brainwash.
It's all basis of capitalism, is to keep people needy.
Oh, yeah.
Keep them feeling a little insecure, a little sick, a little screwed up, so they need...
Keep them buying something.
Buying something is evil. They
should change the slogan of America from, America, land of the free, home of the brave, to America, all you can eat.
Yeah, right.
Isn't that already?
Strictly enforced.
Anyway, on back to Iraq. There's a fragile ceasefire that's barely holding between the Sunni rebels and the U.S. forces in Fallujah, and the U.S. military is suggesting that it is open to a negotiated settlement, but will go all out with all its forces with a full-blown assault if the talks fail. Meanwhile, a U.S. helicopter is down near Baghdad, and the two crew members are dead. 600 Iraqis have been killed over the last week. Iraqis are increasingly sympathetic to the rebels and the increasing hostage crisis. There are some Chinese nationals who have been taken hostage on a day when Dick Cheney is meant to be in China, meeting with Chinese leaders. And the Japanese authorities have given word that their three hostages, two aid workers and one photojournalist, are supposedly to be freed shortly. They've been held by a previously unknown group that have called themselves or have identified themselves as the Mujahideen Brigade.
The Mujahideen is back?
Yeah, I thought they were in Afghanistan last time.
Mujahideen Brigades. This is just another sign of all these various sort of splinter groups, people who have kind of similar aims, but it's not all organized. The hard thing about negotiating to release any of these hostages is that they just don't play by the rules. This is not like you're holding people hostage and they are...
Really? Terrorists not playing by the rules?
They will not adhere to the Geneva Conventions.
Not hardly. Well,
I like the way that Sistani is taking the sort of high road and sort of being diplomatic.
Yeah, I'm above it all.
Yeah. He's just going to wait to see how this falls.
Don't kidnap anybody else.
That upstart. he's nothing but trouble. I always thought so.
Anybody getting the same emails I'm getting? I'm getting loads of people sending me emails about Sistani's website.
www.sistani.org,
and it's in French, English, yes, .org. You can try it out on the computer. Maybe I can even call it up here. No, he's not a .com. He's a .org. The only thing I find distressing is that people are sending me emails kind of sniggering about how he gives advice on oral sex and anal sex and marital relations and breastfeeding children. And
you mean like how-to advice, or...?
When it's appropriate, when it's not.
Isn't Ali Al Sistani. No. This is his cousin Joe Sistani.
No, this is actually, it's not a laughing matter. It's actually very interesting to go to. I'm going to try and get it on my computer.
They have websites like that, too, for Hasidic Jews and, you know, how to act appropriately.
I can't find it.
According to the verses.
They took it down.
To the Talmud.
No, it's very interesting because it is in English, and you can go on and you can understand, you know, what is permissible and what is not allowed.
Well, he is a Muslim cleric. I mean,
it is very informative. It gives you an understanding into Islam. And I think one thing that struck me is particularly interesting on the matter of sex is that as long as things were consensual, it's fine. It's more tolerant than most U.S. states that outlaw practices between consenting adults.
Anything in there about gay
except
marriage?
That women aren't allowed to show themselves and they can't
drive
cars.
Anything about gay marriage in there?
I didn't look up that one, but I think this whole if I can get the website up, we can have a look.
The way he's behaving is sort of like I think all answers to all human problems are either in the first two Godfathers or in Goodfellas. I think that the way Sistani's acting about this Sadir guy is sort of like, you know, he's a cowboy and he's going to have to answer for the contractors. You know what I mean? It's like a Pesci problem.
Yeah.
But he has to tread a fine line, doesn't he? Because on the one hand, he knows that many of the people who are supporting al-Sadir are only doing it really out of frustration, and they don't know what else to do. I don't believe there are that number of kind of really radical people who want mayhem and anarchy to come to Iraq.
Well, what about all those guys in the new Iraqi security forces that just freak out when they're about to march into on their own people and turncoat?
Some of them kind of defected. Yeah, they've actually joined Sadr. But this whole dynamic between Sistani and Sadr, I find fascinating. It's something
the punk's treading on my turf.
Yeah, right. You better cut it out. But hey, you know, we'll see what happens because you know.
I think he's
lives
probably smart. I think he's probably smart.
All right, we'll see it when we come back.
I think he wants all that stuff to play itself out. He's not condemned it, but he's not said go ahead.
Still ahead, we've got our favorite stories of the day. Plus, does academia have the stones to fight back against the politicians? Stay with us here on Air America.
Air America Radio.
That is the single greatest opening line to a joke I have ever heard.
We'll leave no jokes behind.
Mark Maron here, back on Air America Radio's Morning Sedition with Sue Ellicott and Mark Riley. We are on WLIB in New York City, KBLA in Los Angeles. And I'm looking at this story, and we're just talking about depression and my assumption that some of it is a scam to sell medication. But pediatricians and family physicians should not prescribe antidepressants for depressed children and adolescents because the drugs barely work and their side effects are often significant.
Sounds reasonable.
Yeah,
sure does.
How depressed can you be, and about what, you know, when you're 10?
Well, generally, if kids are depressed, there's generally an external reason. I don't know that any of the chemical stuff with people really kicks in until teen years or later. Any of those big serious, like, sort of manic depression.
I've had
one child who was depressed before.
But do they have existential crises? Like, I don't want to live anymore. None of it makes sense.
They go through all of that when they think that when they figure out that they're not going to live and they get scared of death. And if you're lucky, you have a communicative relationship with them and they talk to you about it. And I remember at the same age thinking I was going to die.
I just realized something. I was never comforted when I had those feelings initially, and that's why went away.
Oh.
Yeah,
really?
The sort of existential,
I wasn't comforted
point
either, but they
it?
Eventually went away.
Oh, I was comforted.
I went to military school for 3 years. That'll take anything out of you, believe me.
Really?
Yeah.
You went to military school?
For 3 years.
But I'm talking younger than military school. I'm talking kids, you know, sort of 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, when these thoughts about death, these thoughts of insecurity, bullying at school, and that makes kids depressed. If you notice that your child is really withdrawn and usually outgoing and social and happy and wants to do things, and suddenly all he or she does is come home and lie on the couch or lie on the bed and reads a book and won't engage with anybody, they're depressed.
Didn't Sartre once say that hell is other kids who are on sporting teams?
No, hell to me is other parents cheering along at the sidelines.
I used to hate them. People used to bully me. And the sad thing about bullying is it's a trickle-down theory to it, is that, like, the jocks will bully the artsy kids, and then the artsy kids will bully the geeks. And it just trickles down until the geeks are yelling at the people that, you know, are mutes or something.
Yeah. I don't know. I kind of went through, I guess, a different kind of... I was depressed at 10 when I almost got left back from school.
Yeah.
How do you mean?
Yeah.
Fifth grade. Had to repeat a year, you mean?
Yeah, I almost had to repeat a year. As a matter of fact, the teacher wrote, passed on to the sixth grade without my recommendation. It was on my report card forever. That was the most depressing period of my young life.
Well, I was depressed when I was a kid until I discovered chronic masturbation and the commitment to it.
Which did you do first, the masturbation or the chronic?
Yeah, no, the chronic came much later.
The
first time I got high and my mom caught me. I was like 14. I'd gone across the street and smoked some pot with the guy John Luthi, who lived across the street. I was up in his treehouse, and I came back and I walked into the house, and my mom looked at me and said, "Are you stoned?" And I said, "You know what, Mom? I am." And she looked at me and goes, "Well, why don't you go play guitar? They say you play better when you're like that."
Really?
I was great. No
and
problem.
Then she boxed your ears as you walked past, but that's kind of cool.
Is that, wow. That was kind of giving, wasn't it?
See, if I had gotten caught when I was young, I would have got beat. I mean, my mother stopped beating me up, you know, when I was like maybe 13, 14. And when I say beat me up, I'm just saying corporal punishment.
My parents were afraid to discipline me because they were afraid I wouldn't like them anymore.
Really?
You see, parents are like that. I have a big problem with parents who are frightened of their kids not liking them, because that's how you end up with bratty kids, adults. People who haven't had limits put
how
on
would
them.
I not take this personal?
People like you, Mark Maron.
I am not a brat, Sue Ellicott. You can shut your British head.
You know what? Actually, getting back to the depression thing, is that you're not allowed to be depressed in Britain because nobody cares. I grew up in an era
that's what I was talking about earlier.
Keep it to yourself.
That's what I was talking about earlier. You do not entertain the needy, sad guys, do you?
No, we do now. It's been a whole cultural shift. One of the fantastic imports from America, we've been Oprah-sized.
Oh, is she
yes,
helps?
Yes, you're allowed
oh,
to.
God,
you can
I can't
let
stand.
It all hang
Ooh.
Out. We talk about closure
my
and
dad,
our
see,
feelings.
I got it in there. See, my dad's a manic depressive, which is very exciting, you know, half the time.
Which half is the exciting bit?
I could go into a whole big.
See,
you know,
I'm
so I'm very sensitive to it. You know, I'm very sensitive to depression, and I think some of my criticism of depression and not prescribing pills for everything, because not everything is depression, and a lot of people just take pills because, well, it's a little difficult. I can't make creative choices. I don't know how to finish this book and that kind of stuff.
Do you think
that's
they
not
do
depression?
That? I don't.
Of course they do. People, you can't even go into psychiatrists anymore. That there's no such thing as analysis anymore. There's like hands-on therapy is this thing of the past. Psychiatrists will automatically, without even really having a session, we'll start you on a medication to see if it works for your problem if you're depressed.
Well, doesn't that depend on who they are? And also, there have been all sorts
Not
of
really.
Studies that have shown that, or people have now think that the traditional psychiatry analysis doesn't work anyway.
But that's
you
ridiculous.
End up talking and talking and talking.
It's ridiculous.
Forever. It depends what
it's
problem
ridiculous.
You have, surely. Sometimes you can be helped through certain things. Other people might just be.
But a lot of times,
whiners.
But a lot of times, though, medication, you know, can placate you while you work through stuff. That
mm-hmm.
the idea of medicating without therapy, without real therapy, without talking therapy, is ridiculous in a lot of ways.
So you need a combination, and it depends.
I think so.
On, you
and then
need
you can
50,
eventually.
50. It depends on what's you know what your issues are.
Right,
who
but just
your therapist
blindly
is.
Medicating makes the psychiatrist a pawn of the pharmaceutical industry, and a lot of them just do it. They just medicate right out of the gate, and they don't even go through the therapy sessions.
Well, presumably it's only effective for the length of time of the drug taking, and then once you come off it, you're back to feeling as... Unless you've changed the your
you
external
can change
circumstances.
Your behavior. If you can lighten the load by medicating for like 6 months and, the, you know, and work through the problems
right.
with a therapist...
But that's the key. You
then
have to work through the problems. Otherwise, if you just take the drugs and you don't actually address the really serious, scary stuff that you didn't want to confront, you'll be back at square one.
Change your behavior. You know, make different choices for yourself when you're out from under the fear and the depression.
But I would say don't medicate your kids. Talk to them.
Yeah, first.
Spitball.
Oh, you don't even have kids. What do you know?
You're right, I don't. But I you know, my brother has kids and they should all be on medicine. No, I'm kidding.
No, but you're not. He's only half
I know,
kidding.
He's only half kidding.
Only
no,
half
I'm
kidding.
I'm actually I'm I think medication in almost all situations should be the last thing. Like even with antibiotics, I think, you know, it should be what you resort to when you have no other choices.
Right, so overactive kids and you
I don't know, all
this
stuff
treatment.
Is highly overrated to me. I can't, you know, fix yourself. I mean, kids is a little different, but for grown people, you know, you
fix
don't
yourself.
Need
that's not a very spiritual attitude.
No, mine is buy a bike, cycle through a park. Isn't that kind of...
Yeah, well, that's fixing yourself.
Exactly. I'm
yeah.
a self-fixer.
Yeah.
Oh, you are?
Yeah.
Self-fixer.
You should heal
self-fixer.
Thyself.
There's a lot of ways. I think it's important to ask for help. I think it's important to seek guidance from people you trust. I think it's important to take care of yourself, but that means a lot of different things. You can't, you know.
Suppose you don't trust anybody.
What if you're, well, that's exactly it. How can somebody, if you're a person that doesn't trust anybody or is a little nuts yourself, how can you trust yourself to fix you if you can't even trust other people?
Uh-oh.
I trust myself before I trust other people.
Mm-hmm. And you think you're a pillar of psychological stability?
No, I'm just here. You know.
No, but he understands himself better than anybody else.
That's right. Yeah. I don't understand anybody.
It's
I
like
certainly
laughing
don't
at
understand
your own
you,
jokes.
Marin.
Doesn't your husband ever tell you things about you that you would never be able to see about you and make you question? You know.
Yeah.
That makes
yourself?
Her throw
exactly.
things at him.
No.
So you have to rely on outside you know, opinion somewhat in order to see yourself clearly. You have to get information from other people.
That's true, and especially the negative stuff.
Later for getting information from other people.
Okay.
You should be able to figure it out for yourself.
Okay, buddy. Well, let's hear. Here's the Morning Sedition Business
Mark
Report. Big news in the business world is the development of robots that can care for the elderly. In the future, our elders will be comforted by daily visits from android caregivers, and their children and grandchildren will no longer be burdened by the wisdom and maturity that old people are always trying to impose on them. Attention, investors. Once you've spent the tens of millions of dollars building each individual robot, they make for great cheap labor. Robots are the illegal immigrants of the future. Hardworking, industrious, and a different color. They represent a new generation for humans to hate and be intolerant towards. And if you want to see how that pans out, see the movie Blade Runner. That's where that goes. And that is our morning... Wait, is that all of it? Oh, there's more. Wait. For the first time, elderly people will be able to form their own personal armies of relentless killbots who will make their ungrateful grandchildren pay for their neglect. There you go. There's a Morning Business Report that I didn't even know had two pages to it.
All right. Coming up, the end of intellect. Plus, you on the telephones at 866-303-2270. But first, a quick check of the headlines on the half hour.
Mark Maron back with Mark Riley and Sue Ellicott here on Air America's Morning Sedition. Remember when thinking and studying used to be considered good things, ways to succeed? Well, no, it's been a while. More recently, anyone who qualifies as an academic or intellectual seems to come under suspicion for, you know, knowing stuff. But joining us now is the point man of what might just be a battle to remind people that knowing stuff is good. His name is Stanley Fish, and he's not only a dean at the University of Illinois at Chicago, he's also written a column on politicians and professors, and he joins us now on the phone. Hello, are you there, Mr. Fish?
Yes, I am. Good morning to you.
Good morning to you. It's Mark, Sue, and Mark.
Mark, Sue, and Mark.
Yeah.
I'm the Sue.
So what's wrong with the way university administrators relate to politicians?
Well, they come in with hat in hand, apologetic, defensive, admit to everything they've been accused of, and then expect the people they're talking to respect them.
So you say they're too nice.
They're too nice, and they don't defend the enterprise, and they give in to the various forces that I think are now attempting to dismantle higher education, especially public higher education.
Who are those forces?
Well, there are a bunch of them. There are politicians who are attempting, let's say, in Congress to pass bills that tie federal aid to tuition hikes. There are groups of students organized by David Horowitz under the false name Students for Academic Freedom, who survey the political affiliation of their faculties and then report these statistics to newspapers and to other watchdog groups. And they are members of houses of legislators in the various states who are trying to monitor the content of college courses and make sure that what is taught in college courses corresponds to the largely corporate ethics that they represent.
And also the rightist political ideology, yes?
Yes, absolutely right. And they do this by actually pointing to a correct fact, which is that a large percentage of academics, that is faculty members in the humanities and social sciences especially, identify themselves as being left of center or democratic. They then conclude from this that every single course in the university, no matter what its topic, is really a course in un-Americanism or unpatriotism or anti-religionism. And they actually persuade people who never were in a university classroom or haven't been in one in 35 years that this is going on.
But, you know, it's like, it seems to me that these are the same people that assaulted, you know, the whole political correct ideology within colleges, and that's sort of what's going on. But it seems to me that a lot of political correctness, certainly within college campuses, was a good thing.
Well, yes and no. It depends on what you mean by it.
I mean that, you know, there are programs now for people that were unrepresented within
absolutely right.
The educational community.
That is, programs like women's studies, African-American studies, even Jewish studies, gay and lesbian studies, Chicano studies, wouldn't have been in the university at this moment were it not for community political activism from the outside. And, of course, each of these programs was resisted and now is resisted by the members of the right who are attempting these new tactics and always attempting them in the name of shining virtues like fairness, objectivity, and now, in a kind of brilliant move, they've commandeered the word diversity to argue for what they call intellectual diversity, which is really affirmative action for conservatives. The idea being that if you find on your faculty that 30% of the faculty is conservative and 70% in the sense of voting conservatively in elections, you then have a mandate to go out and hire some conservatives. As if your political affiliation absolutely tracked your academic interests, an assumption which is simply false.
Well, it's like it's sad because now, you know, you want kids to be able to go to college and have, you know, like existential crises, you know, and sexual identity problems and sort of like, you know, playing with the idea of being a socialist or an existentialist, and they're trying to stop all that fun college stuff.
They're trying to stop it, and they do it, as always, under these wonderful names. One thing the right is great at, and the progressive left has never picked up on, is how to frame an issue in a nice-sounding phrase. Right to work, right to life, political correctness, partial birth abortion, Patriot Act.
Do you have any? Do you have any framed ones?
No, I'm afraid not.
That's our job.
We got to call George Lakoff.
Absolutely. I think, for example, Students for Academic Freedom should be called Students for McCarthyite Surveillance.
But see, that was good, but it was a little wordy at the end.
Absolutely. And that's part of the problem with academics like us. We get too interested in the brilliance of our own formulations and forget about the audience we're trying to influence.
But Stanley Fish, Dean of the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences at the University of Illinois at Chicago, why do academics take this bashing? Can't you do something to stand up for yourselves? You're a bright bunch.
It's a question of the kind of leadership that now occupies most offices in universities. You can remember, at least I can remember, when academic leaders, that is university presidents or chancellors, were respected figures. People asked them for advice, not only on academic matters, but in general on matters of interest to society. They have now become, I know I hate this phrase, but it's true, a crowd of faceless bureaucrats. People who don't have the courage of their convictions, and in fact don't any longer remember what their convictions are. You cannot name, I can't name, and I'm in the business, I can't name three academic presidents in this country who stand up for the enterprise, who try to resist the pressures to politicize the university, who say, no, we don't want to necessarily get in bed with all the corporate interests. No academic leaders say things like that. And, of course, if your leaders aren't saying these things, it's unlikely that you people who work in the trenches are going to be saying them either.
Stanley, we need to get you on one of those makeover shows.
Yeah, right.
Thanks for talking to us, Stanley Fish. We're going to take some calls right now.
We appreciate the time.
Pleasure talking to you.
Good luck.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Stanley Fish from the University of Illinois at Chicago.
Did I not say that at the beginning? That he was from the University of Illinois?
Yeah, you did.
Oh, you did, but I thought that we should, just in case someone had just woken up
and was filling up
their coffee pot, we should just mention who he was again, in case they thought, who is that fourth Mark?
Do you ever have that weird moment where you just think, like, you know, what have I done for the last 4 hours? Where am I? Who are these people I'm talking to?
Yeah.
Do we have some callers on the phone?
No, we have to open up the phones.
We do? All right, well, we're taking your calls at 866-303-AARZERO. That's 866-303-2270. Give us a call about whatever's on your mind.
Here's what I don't understand, okay?
Yes.
I'm living right up by the Columbia campus in Manhattan,
mm-hmm.
and every block around where I am is a cafe, a restaurant, an ice cream place, packed with students eating out the whole time. When I was a student, we could barely afford to go out and sit and have, you know, toast and tea.
Do you know how much it costs to go to Columbia?
Yeah.
Well, clearly, but that's what I mean.
About 38 G.
This is a very kind of high-income crowd, right?
Oh, yeah.
Mm.
Definitely.
Okay, should we go? Is there anybody on the line?
Yeah, Jay, I think, is on the line.
Yeah, he wants to talk about medicating children, which is a really interesting topic, I think, for a lot of people. Jay, good morning.
Hi.
How you doing?
Okay.
You're in Shreveport, huh?
Oh, yeah.
You're streaming us?
Yeah.
All right.
Thanks.
We appreciate it.
The only thing on.
Oh, Jay, you just wounded us so deeply.
No.
The only good thing on, you meant.
The only thing on here.
Oh. Okay. Oh. All right, great.
Thank you. No. Thank you for correcting that. The check's in the mail.
Yeah. I mean, it's like the TV and the radio here sucks.
Oh, God.
Okay.
But the food's great.
Put it that way.
Yeah, the food's good, huh?
Do you have a question for us, Jay?
Well, yeah. It's like, you know, we're having a George Carlin moment here. You know, medicating children and really like what he said about religion, organized religion being, a dangerous mental condition.
Uh-oh.
Oh, that said that a few days ago. Yeah.
Wait a minute. Did Marin pay you to make this phone call?
No.
Is he putting this on his Verizon bill?
No.
Are you sure? Because you're the first person that's called here that's agreed with Mark Marin's assessment of religion.
Well, you know, look at it this way. We medicate children and use all these drugs to equalize our brains, thinking that we're off center somehow. Mm-hmm. You know, we feel bad, we feel good, we're up, we're down.
Let me just say, Jay, that you're a very, 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 very tolerant country.
Oh, well, yeah. Yeah.
I just mean that anybody's entitled to say, think, feel, reason what they like, and, you know, pop pretty much any pill they want, as far as I can make out.
So your point is, Jay?
But, you know, you say that we can say what we want, but no one listens.
Right.
There's no one listening. Okay. We have freedom of speech, but we don't have responsibility to listen.
Mm-hmm. We're listening to you.
Okay, we're throwing open our phone lines just for that, Jay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the
call.
Call
us at 1-866-303-AARO. That's 1-866-303-2270, because I can never figure out that letter thing on the phone.
Right. We got Joe.
Okay, we're going to go to Diane,
Chicago.
Hello, Diane.
Hi, Diane. Diane?
Are you there?
Diane.
She's coming.
Diane, are you listening?
Hi.
Are you listening on WNTD 950 AM, or are you streaming?
I sure am.
Oh, all excellent. Right. Thank you.
I'm loving every minute of it.
Great. What's your question for us
today?
Here's
what's on my mind. I've been unemployed for almost a year and a half.
What job do you do normally?
I'm an administrative assistant, actually, in universities, a university administration, research centers. Actually, I worked at the University of Illinois was my last job.
Oh, wow.
So, Stanley Fish, if you're listening, I need a job.
Send him a resume.
I'm not kidding. Well, here's the problem. I mean, I don't know exactly what the problem is. My last couple of jobs, I've never had a problem. No one has ever criticized me for not doing a good job, not doing my work. I really feel like I'm kind of castigated for my worldview. I mean, it's very, no one ever can give me a reason. And I think, you know, I haven't been able to get references from these people. And I'm just kind of out here.
I have to say, hang in there. My advice would be to call up any sort of place that you feel you would like to get your foot through the door and ask if you can volunteer for 1 week or 2 weeks. And I would guarantee you've done that.
Yes, I've done that, and it's been actually very nice. But, you know, nobody is hiring.
So they let you volunteer for a week, and then they say thanks for helping out?
Well, actually, after I volunteered for a little while, I went on an interview to work with the executive director of this position, of this place, and the guy said, you know what, he said, I'm not going to hire you, because number one, you are interested in issues, number two, you like to organize things.
Uh-oh, you sound too good.
You're subversive.
Yeah.
But, you know, that was so strange. I thought, my God, I've been doing this work for 25 years, that's interesting.
Yeah.
And he said, I really think you're a lot like me. I don't know. I mean, I just want to get a job and make some, you know, just kind of live my life.
Diane, none of it makes sense at all until you finally get the job. Take it from me.
Thanks a lot, Diane. Good luck with
getting a job. Thank you very much for calling. Coming up, more of you on the telephones. Our number is 866-303-AARO. That's 866-303-2270. And this is Air America Radio. Air America Radio, speaking truth to power, making fun of idiots.
I'm Sue Ellicott here on Air America with Mark Riley and Mark Maron, and we're taking your calls at 866-303-AARO. That's 866-303-2270. And first, we're going to go to Alice in Alexandria, Virginia. Hi, Alice.
Hello.
What's up today?
Well, I wanted to make a comment about the medication mental illness issue. When I was 18, I was diagnosed with a panic anxiety disorder.
Right.
And they put me on a bunch of medication. I can't even explain how many medications I was on. And it wasn't until I was about 24, I'm 25 now, that I realized that I didn't have a problem. I was just an adult.
Exactly. Exactly. Right? It's scary being an adult.
It was a great revelation because I realized I don't need these medications. I just have to deal with adult problems.
So you feel that the people are over-medicated?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
absolutely.
Thanks for calling. That's great.
And the second one thing I wanted to comment about was being British and dealing with mental illness.
Yes.
My husband's from London. We've been married for 5 years. And he married me.
Sorry, Mark is just commiserating with you that you have to share your life with somebody British. He's very open-minded, Mark Maron.
He's wonderful, adorable, the most handsome man in the world, but he has depression, and nothing that he treats with medication. It's just a thing that pops up every once in a while. But, I lost my train of thought.
Is it in the winter?
No, it's not in the winter. It seems to be job-related. But it was never allowed to be discussed by his family.
No, that is true about the Brits. They are a bit uptight.
He married me, an American Jew, and we're...
Well, good for him. That was the road to recovery.
We're emotive in my family, to say the very least. And it's been quite the revelation for him. So now when he has an emotion, he expresses it. This is how I feel, and I'm saying it to you, and it feels so great.
But are you saying that you like that or you don't like that?
I love it.
Good.
It's so funny about Jews who marry. Like, my wife, I'm a Jewish person, and my wife is this sort
Lanzmann.
Of...
Lanzmann.
Oh, yeah, is that your name? Oh, yeah, no, I'm Lanzmann, yeah. But but she's also very, it's not that she's not emotive, but she's a little, she's a kind of tough love kind of person. And I was married to a Jewish person once, too, and there was just too much insanity. Is she gone now?
Oh, well, I think that's, the point that she makes about British people being more, hiding that stuff away or not feeling comfortable.
And drinking,
that has changed. Yes, I mean, no, you joke. I lived back in London for a year last year. It was scary to me, the amount of drunkenness all day long, because the pubs are open from the morning right until last thing at night. A lot of people deal with any issues that they have, whether it's just loneliness, unhappiness, frustration, by suppressing it all under alcohol. And that's true in America, too, but it's so obvious in Britain because they forget to eat.
Oh, my God.
Ooh.
Right now we have Joanne on the line. Joanne in Brooklyn. Are you there? Hello, Joanne?
Hi.
What's going on?
Well, first I wanted to thank you guys for being on the air. I've been listening to you like 24/7 since you came on. It's the best thing that's happened to radio. I don't even watch TV anymore.
Oh, thank you.
I wanted to be the second person to agree with Mark Maron's opinion on religion.
Oh, thank you.
I'm a big fan of George Carlin, and I agree 100% that he did a great bit on Bill Maher recently where he talked about all the problems in this world based on religion and religious beliefs and religious leaders who fire up people to do the worst things, going all the way back to the Crusades and the Inquisition. And that's one of the reasons it's so important to keep separation of church and state in this country.
Absolutely right.
And they're not doing such a good job, though, are they?
No, that's one of the reasons we have to get that moron out of there.
Oh,
yeah. So, I mean, I just want to say that there's at least two of us out there, Mark, who agree with you.
Oh, well, thank you. We're working on getting the moron out now.
Okay, great.
All right. Take care, Joanne.
Thanks for the call. Right now we go to Heather, who's calling us from Chicago. Heather, good morning.
Hi, how are you?
All right, how you doing?
Good. I wanted to, I was listening to Stanley Fisher from UIC, and it reminded me of an article that was in the Chicago Tribune last week about Northwestern University and how they're, want to reweight the grades because a lot of students are succeeding and doing well and getting too many A's that they want to make it harder for people to succeed and excel in classes. And I was just wondering what your guys' opinion is because they want to do this throughout the country. It's not just Northwestern, but it seems like once students are doing well and that's what they want in educational system, it seems like they want to start to make it harder and impossible for people to,
But Heather, it depends how they're doing well, really. I mean, a lot of it is all this argument about grade inflation everybody's really scared about lawsuits from parents and students when they don't do as well as they thought they were going to do. And to keep everybody quiet, their tests are basically easier or that they've lowered the bar. I mean, if you can go out there against international competition, students from other countries who have supposedly gone through the same sort of education and you are as good as they are, maybe there's a case, but I think that there's a concern that consistently students in the United States don't measure up.
Thanks for calling. We have Jessica from Wellesley, Massachusetts. Are you there, Jessica?
Yep, I'm here.
What's on your mind?
Hello. I just had a comment about the whole medical kind of depression and medicine thing, and also love your show, Wicked Awesome.
Thank you.
that's no promo. Wicked Awesome. Great.
That's very Massachusetts.
I am a Massachusetts girl. Proud.
Wicked Pissah.
Well, not New Hampshire.
Okay.
I just had to say that I think you guys started off with a good topic about, medicating children, but I really think that all the callers who were calling in were talking about themselves being medicated as adults, which is really a totally different thing. People who take medication can't blame it on the people who prescribe it.
Mm-hmm.
And I take Zoloft, I take Adderall, I have ADD, and I have depression, and it has made my life completely different. It's like I'm not depressed. I'm happy. I go out. I listen to your radio show. I, you know.
Stay on it. Whatever you do, stay on it.
Stay on it, right.
Is it okay to still blame your dealer when he gives you some bad stuff?
No, it's not. It's your responsibility.
Caveat emptor.
Uh-huh. And it's also your responsibility if you're the parent who's taking the drugs.
Right.
If you're the parent who's taking the easy way out.
Uh-huh.
These medicines, these can change your life. These can do great things. But people need to stop blaming the media. They need to stop blaming their doctors. They're adults. It's their responsibility.
You're right.
I take my medicine. I do things in my life to change my life. I don't whine about it. And that's how we're being portrayed. And it's really not true. And I love joking around. I think jokes are, I mean, comedy is humanity's great, best thing we've ever had. I love making fun of myself. But in reality, it's a really bad stereotype.
Okay, Jessica, I think you're right. And the thing to do is to keep on checking in with a doctor and make sure that you're monitored.
Once a month. I go once a month.
Excellent. Okay.
You know?
Thank you for pointing that out.
Make sure your levels are right.
Well, you know, she was right about the...
Thank
you very much, Jessica.
The difference between medicating adults and medicating kids. I mean, kids really don't have that much to say about it in many cases.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, I understand what she was saying.
Yeah.
And I think it is there are certain issues that really, you know, need medicine, and medicine's provided a lot of comfort for people. I just think the over prescribing of medicine for people who are just a little uncomfortable with their condition in the world is not quite right.
Also, a lot of the medication of kids is just that many parents either don't have or are unwilling to make or don't know how to make the time and communicate properly with their kids and pay attention to what actually is causing the problem. It can sometimes take weeks or months to figure out that you have a child being bullied at school because they won't tell you.
So you don't know if they're depressed or just dealing with some
reality.
Well,
they are depressed, but you don't know what
it
is.
But there could be,
and with children, you can explain away, oh, it's just a phase they're going through.
Yeah. Well, it would seem to me that most of the time, I would think that children have a reason to be upset and just have to dig it out of them.
You really do have to dig it out of them. It takes time. But you can get it out of them. My wife does this really, really well with my daughter. I don't do it nearly as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, when I ask her what's wrong,
do you do this?
Nothing,
what?
Nothing. Nah.
All right.
No, I just say, like, you know, is there
like
anything wrong?
Though?
Is it okay? Nothing's wrong. Everything's okay. 5 minutes later, she spills her guts to my wife.
I know. You have to be there at bedtime.
Yeah.
Has the fax come in yet, or are we still waiting for the fax?
I think the fax may be on its way.
The timing's amazing. Now it's time for us to broadcast our much-feared liberal agenda. As you know, our philosophical leader, Ms. Barbara Streisand, gives us a daily rundown of all our important liberal causes. And here it is, fresh out of the machine. Remember, liberal soldiers, write these down. 1. Inundate the airwaves with offensive mock devotionals. Check. 2. Clean up from Easter Sunday orgy. Check. Pry guns from the cold, dead fingers of NRA members. All right. Make sure Ted Kennedy's podium water glass is filled with vodka. Pitch reality show to network. Average Joe Stalin. Buy Christopher Hitchens a round of wood alcohol. 2 alcohol jokes.
Ooh.
We actually are encouraging 2 drunks to, you know, continue drinking as much as possible, which, as you know, cancels out Recovery Corner. And that's the whole yin yang of what we're doing here. That's our liberal agenda for today. Fair and balanced. Exactly.
Didn't you love the fact that you mentioned the NRA, that Bush at the weekend complained that one of the problems in Iraq was all these armed militias running around. This was the same time he had the head of the NRA staying with him at his ranch.
Yeah.
Mm. The right to bear arms, folks, is okay in America, but not in Iraq.
Nothing quite like consistency, folks.
Do as we say, don't do as we do.
Absolutely. Okay. Join us tomorrow on Air America when John Stossel will explain to us how we've got it all wrong. Plus, the man who keeps revealing what Bush insiders really think before the White House came to discredit them. We'll talk to author Ron Suskin tomorrow on Morning Sedition here on Air America Radio.
Yo.
See ya.